It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Here we go on this autumnal equinoctial version of the horn. It is the 22nd day of September 2020. HeadOn.live is where this program resides on the interweb tubes. That's also the best place for you to go to get the live stream, to get, say, you can also follow my Twitter feed there. And, of course, it's also where we keep the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room, a great way to augment your listening experience. Right now, if you go over and pick out a screen name and a password, if you don't already have one, and jump in, you'll be immediately greeted by early arriver Squeaky, and capably moderated by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third-stage guild navigator, has in fact folded space to become Man Cave, and he is capably assisted by his trusty pinch-hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all-around great guy, Steve from Georgistan. Let's see. Apparently, it's only 88 degrees up there in the Man Cave right now, so that sort of explains things. Only 88 degrees. Here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cold Trump Genistan, we didn't get out of the mid-60s today. But regardless, it was an exquisite day. Summer said goodbye with its loveliest farewell. This is three straight days of not a cloud in the sky, a blue that is indescribably blue and seems to go on forever. And so today, I ran errands. I got out in that lovely blue sky. Well, not in the sky, actually. I was still here on the earth. I mean, you know, gravity being what it is. But I ran errands because yesterday, in the mailbox, Agnes and I received our absentee ballots. And so last night, we sat in bed together, and we got out our blue or black pens, carefully read our instructions, and filled out our ballots. And it goes without saying that there are already at least two votes for Joe Biden that have been turned in, because that's what I did this morning. I wasn't going to rest on this one. This morning I got up and took our two sealed ballots and signed and all of that stuff. I took them with me over to the county clerk's office at the Fayette County Courthouse, and I turned them in. And because I was manually delivering them, and you know, check your forms and everything if you're going to do anything like this, I had to make sure and sign the attestation line on the envelope itself. Because, it's kind of like a golf scorecard. Billable Rick could tell you about this, you know, that says attest. You know, you have to attest the scorecard. Well, you have to attest your absentee ballot, at least here in West Virginia. And then we also had to sign it. And there's a rule here. I didn't know about this. Here in West Virginia, one person can only turn in two absentee ballots. So, well, it worked out nicely. Agnes and me, I signed both on the attestation line and turned them both in. Damn, nicotine pouches. Hiccups. That's a side effect, apparently. And here we are in something like day number 9 of not smoking. And things are getting a little easier. And I'm finding ways to make it easier. Trying not to eat the world. Sorry about that. Yeah, maybe we'll get some relief now. Trying not to eat the world and trying to get exercise. So when I got back from dropping off our ballots, the first thing I did is I ran down to what used to be Rite Aid and is now Walgreens. And being as how I'm one of 27 million or so uninsured in this country, I've got myself a flu shot. I hadn't planned on getting it this early, but it seemed the better part of valor. So if it's 50% effective for 6 months, that means, let's see, I should be good through about the end of March-ish. And then, when all was said and done, I picked up some magnesium to go with our calcium and our vitamin D. Picked up a multivitamin for Agnes and me. Got a new bottle of ibuprofen. Took all that home and then turned around and went down to the local rail trail. And it was the best possible use I could have made of the day. The rail trail is largely in the shade. It's 2 miles to the bottom of the mountain and 2 miles back. I didn't do the whole 2 miles, but all told, I did about 2 miles. But it's almost, most of it's entirely in the shade, so it was, where it was like 63, 64 degrees up in the sunlight, it was more like 55 degrees in the shade. And I walked that old narrow-gauge rail track and pretty much had it to myself. And I did something spectacular for me. There's a restored railroad trestle that begins the trail. And I had my, 10-year-old Merrill hikers on. Because they've got some ankle protection, ankle support. And I haven't done this in a while. But I'm trying to live the life and get healthy and everything. So I'd say that that trestle is every bit of 100-plus yards long. And it's not much. For those of you who are out there and bust your ass and run 15, 20 miles a day or anything, I'm sure, go ahead, laugh. But I ran the trestle part, and it was easy because it was the beginning of the walk. And frankly, with my long legs, I walk faster than some people. I walk faster than some people run. But I ran the trestle part, and then proceeded to walk about a mile and a quarter down that narrow gauge track, and then scrambled off the beaten path and wandered around the ruins of an old coal complex and got out onto the boulders in the middle of the creek and sat and contemplated my navel and then contemplated the waterfalls around me. Felt the warmth of the sun out on those rocks. kind of lizard-like. And eventually, I got some photos and video and stuff. I'll post it online so you can just see how exquisitely beautiful it was. And then hiked briskly back up the trail, got back to the trestle, and by then my calves and my thighs were, my hammies were burning, which I take as a good sign. And I ran the trestle at the very end of it. And at no point during any of that, and I was at it for a couple of hours, when you include the scrambling. At no point in any of that did I want a cigarette, which is a good sign. And as I was huffing and puffing my way back up the trail, because in that 2 miles, it drops, oh, I think 370 feet, something like that. Maybe more. I felt great. I absolutely felt great. It was wonderful. And drinking water along the way, and I had my little glucose tablets with me in case my sugar bottomed out, and had some peanut butter and crackers. Oh, a little unpaid product placement. I also bought and took with me a protein bar just in case. Man, do those things taste like shit. It was like lemon icebox pie flavored. And there was no sugar, or, you know, no high fructose corn syrup. 20-gram protein load. And it did. The lemon part was pretty good, and it all gave way to just, it was like chewing on chalk-flavored bubble gum. But I guess it serves its purpose, and I've got those handy now, just in case. Oh, but I can't tell you how gorgeous it was, and the thoughts that went swimming around my head. I mean, I thought about my father. My father played up and down that trail as a boy, but when there were still railroad trains coming up the creek, and learn to swim in that swimming hole. And if we get another warm day like this, another beautiful day like this, yeah, I'm taking the Speedo with me and I'm getting in. Oh yeah, oh yeah. So that was my day, and I really wanted it to go on forever, but had to get thing, you know, got to be here, because it's Titanic Tuesday. And of course, every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude, and this program is no different. So thanks go out to our 22nd day of the month subscribers, and to folks jumping in on Larry from Liberalville's challenge from last night. So that means thanks to Cecilia. And thank you to Colin. Thank you to Felicia, twice. Thank you to Tirani. Thank you to Bill in Florida. Thank you to Chris in Germany. Thank you all very kindly for being subscribers and or taking part in the challenge here as summer turns to autumn, and as we bid a fond farewell to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and indeed hoist a hefty glass of beverage of your choice in her memory and in thanks to all the good that she did with her life. My God, if you set her, if in the scales of justice that we use as the fundamental image of the idea of justice in this country, if you set Ruth Bader Ginsburg on one of the pans, and you started adding in, say, old Balls and Strikes John Roberts. Pan doesn't move. Ruth Bader Ginsburg still got it pinned to the ground. Okay, add in fat dead Tony Scalia. Still didn't move. Add in Sammy Bad Breath shoot the black kid in the back of the head, even though he's no threat Alito. Pan still doesn't move. And they're still in midair. add in Brett, I like beer, Kavanaugh. Pan doesn't move. Add in Ann's boy, Neil Gorsuch. Pan still doesn't move. Add in Clarence Pubes on the Coke can, Slappy Thomas. Pan doesn't move. Add in that old junkie Rehnquist. Pan doesn't move. Add in Anthony, my kid was Donald Trump's banker, Kennedy. The pan still doesn't move. Ruth Bader Ginsburg did more good in her life than every Republican for the last 75 years combined. And, you know, I think it was, ancient Egyptian mythology? Where in the afterworld, the god Mot, is it Mot, I think, weighs the soul of the departed against a feather. Well, suffice to say, I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg's soul would outweigh that of the feather. And she certainly used her time on this planet for far more good than any of those worthless goddamned Republicans who sit and whilst wearing their black robes, looking down their noses at the rest of us, and do the bidding of their filthy corporate masters. Yeah. Oh, and so as a consequence of the success of the challenge last night, we have a week of fundraising free radio, which is freaking awesome. Yep, that's right. That's right, Irish Dave. Can't forget Sandra Day O'Connor, who yet lives. Yeah, you can put her on that pan, too. You can put 100 Republican justices of the Supreme Court on that pan, and it will not balance out against Ruth Bader Ginsburg for an instant. Yeah. But we do. We've got fundraising-free radio for the remainder of the month, with one exception, and that is our dear friend Tony and Chico. A challenge does remain on the table from Tony, seeking more and new subscribers. There's $90 remaining for 9 new subscribers, or 1 new $90 a month subscriber, or 2 at 45, etc. $90 remain in Tony and Chico's new subscriber challenge. He will double the first month's subscription through the end of September for those who jump in. So we've still got that going on, and I will mention that, because it would be a shame. Tony's been a subscriber for as long as we've had subscribers. So thank you, Tony, and hopefully, folks will take advantage of that opportunity. Ron and Raleigh with a note. There's a reason women of color are being sterilized without their knowledge or permission in ICE facilities. One would think that America's lawyers would be looking out for these women, yet we haven't heard a mumbling word from Bill Barr or Dolt 45. The reason for this is that these women are black and brown. Can you imagine if white women were subjected to these atrocities? I guess old Bill Barr is too busy shilling for T-Rump to do his damn job. I hate these motherfuckers. Oh, I hate them too. Hate is a destructive emotion, but I'm willing to waste a little bit of it on these remorseless bastards. I mean, how much more Third Reich can you get than involuntary sterilization? Now, mind you, it's not like the first time this has happened. You could add old Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. to that pan, and he still wouldn't outweigh Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And remember, it was Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. who, as a member of the Supreme Court, voted to uphold involuntary sterilization of black women early in the 20th century, writing, "Three generations of idiots is enough." Mm-hmm. A big believer in eugenics, old Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. was, in addition to being a cokehead, of course. So we've done it before. This is retrograde motion. That's what the astrophysicists would call it. It's when we start moving backwards when we ought to be going forward. Oh, dear. Ron in Raleigh tells me, those protein bars are made of hoofs and other disgusting things. I poured out a 40-ounce for the notorious RBG. They're going to replace her with a woman that rode her coattails and pulled up the ladder behind her. If it wasn't for the work of RBG, none of the women named to replace her would have been able to go to law school or find a job in a firm. That's true. Whoever replaces Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be the functional equivalent of Clarence Pubes on the Coke can, Slappy Thomas, who pulled up the ladder after him, after all the milestones that were established by his predecessor, Thurgood Marshall. What the Democrats giveth, the Republicans taketh away. Dave number 11 recommending Kind bars, saying lots of flavors and they're delicious. That's a possibility. But I still got five more of these lemon chalk bars to get through, so there's that. Yeah. Steve in New York asking, did you get your $100 Soros voucher after you voted? No, like all my other Soros checks, they're apparently being held up somewhere in the mail. Well, it may be in the 60s here and headed for the 50s, but by God, up in lovely La Crosse, it's 81 degrees and feels like 84 under a blue sky with some sheep grazing. Sounds lovely, Flavio. Just lovely. A personal floor motion coming from Silent R. Lamar. I'd like to start referring to Steve from Georgistan as Big Steve if it's not taken. That's entirely up to Steve from Georgistan. I think he's pretty happy being pinch hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all around great guy. It's sort of got more, I don't know, more heft, more breadth of expression, and more poetry in that. But I'm in a considerably better mood than I was yesterday. And hopefully, well, I'll manage to maintain it as the light fails. Because that's the undeniable primary effect of the autumnal equinox. The failing of the light. I mean, the light's been failing since the summer solstice. But now it's going to get real ugly. Now we're down to equal parts day and night, and starting today or tomorrow, there will be less day than there is night. And that's rough. And I'm going to have to, do something light-wise, or else I'll be a miserable sod by the time we get to the winter solstice, which again is a happy day. But I had a note earlier from our pal Reverbo, the human man. Reverbo, referring to something I said yesterday, said, regarding no bottom to their evil, do you think the vampires would trade the presidency and possibly the Senate for another conservative Supreme Court judge? Absolutely. Because now Chinless Mitch has found himself an excuse to explain away the hypocrite that he is. And so they're going to do it. And we're probably going to be left to just deal with it and hope that maybe the Democrats can find enough spine to rectify it. But hey, it's all predicated upon one thing. Okay, two things. Everybody on our side of the aisle gets out there and votes like their lives depend on it. Because they do. if you are a white, privileged male like me, get out there and vote like your life depends on it, because it does. And if you are a white, privileged male like me, get out there and use that privilege to vote for the sake of women of all colors. Vote for the vote for marginalized peoples everywhere. Every stripe in the LGBTQ rainbow flag, every stripe in the trans flag. Vote for Black Lives Matter. Vote for a gasping and wheezing environment that faces the elimination of God only knows how many statutes being struck down and regulations being struck down. Vote for all of those things. All of those people. Vote for the air. Vote for the water. Vote for the land. Vote for the very planet itself. Vote for generations as yet unborn and undreamt. Vote like your lives depend upon it. And then for everybody else who isn't a white, privileged male, well, this should be a no-brainer. Vote, 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 vote. The only way, and we know this from the gaming scenario of a few months back, the only way that we get an uncontestable election is to overwhelm the maggots. It can't be close. It has got to be a tsunami. That blue wave that we were so fond of talking about in 2018. No, we've got to be able to stand on the shore, watch the entire ocean get sucked back out to sea, and then come back in with the maggots lined up saying, there ain't no such thing as climate change or blue tsunamis. There ain't no such thing. And watch a towering wave of liberal, progressive, democratic votes overwhelm them and sweep them out as if they never were. Because in answer to Reverbo's question, do you think the vampires would trade the presidency and possibly the Senate for another conservative Supreme Court judge? Absolutely, especially in light of the fact that they think that they've got the fix in. And they're going to keep the White House and keep the Senate. Are you, for instance, in a state where there's not going to be a meaningful contest over your senators? Why not reach out and see about doing some phone banking? I've been thinking about doing that myself. Kind of good at that whole phone thingy. Think about making calls into Colorado and Arizona and Montana. Think about making calls into Maine and South Carolina, Stan, and hell yes, Kentucky and Texas and Georgia. Because that's the only way we win. Because if we win, then come January, we can start, within the context of whatever this pandemic is, or wherever it is by then, we can start pressing. With Biden in the White House and Kamala Harris as his vice president, we can begin to press. And we can press the House to pass a bill to change the makeup of the Supreme Court and, you know, essentially emasculate, neuter those filthy right-wing judges who never should have been there in the first place. Eliminating the power and influence of Ann's boy Neil and Brat Kavanaugh and whichever retrograde nightmare anti-feminist gets the nod on Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat. Eliminating their effectiveness would be a beautiful first step in an overall process that is known by its Latin term damnatio memoriae, erasing Donald Trump from the history of this nation. Oh, and by the way, it looks like Big Steve's out the window. Big Steve's not a possibility because Steve in New York said, at some point, friends of mine assigned the moniker BGS, Big Gay Steve, to me. The best part of it was when I would meet friends and of friends who had never met and would say, oh, you're BGS. Feel free to refer to me, Steve in New York says, as BGS, Big Gay Steve. Well, I think we'll stick with, you know, what we've got so far. I'm easily confused. Oh, and last night's show was incredible with Darlene, Billable Rick, and you all in a roundtable format. Just wonderful. Billable had quite a day yesterday. He called Randy's show, called you on the horn, and managed to cheat his way to get under 100 on the golf course. I'm concerned that score may be a bit titanically trumped up, considering that's how Trump always makes up a good score at the end of his round and uses the orange golf balls that light up after dark.
And they said, improve your lie, sir, so I kicked it out into the fairway.
Joey continues, we have a sports writer here in Akron by the name of Sheldon Ocker. And Sheldon has been writing for well over 50 years. He's superb. On one of last week's programs, you mentioned Lorraine, Ohio, when speaking with Silent R. Lamar. Yeah, that was the story of the cops showing up and declaring the funeral for a young man driven to his death by the police a riot. That's what the Lorraine, Illyria area is a multiracial, working-class, struggling community due to the loss of jobs from the auto industry. Over the years, Sheldon Ocker has featured stories in the local paper about the defining line between Lorraine, Illyria, and the affluent Cleveland Western suburbs such as Bay Village, Avon Lake, and Sheffield Lake. Literally, as you leave Sheffield Lake and cross over the Black River, then continue over Route 57, which I refer to as the Heinz 57 Highway because of all the diversity on the other side of the road, you immediately witness going from the upper-class neighborhoods to the poorer neighborhoods of that region in a matter of minutes. It is stark and striking to see the sudden abrupt divergence of lifestyles. Sheldon Ocker has written about the plight of these suburbs over the years. Now, let's go from Sheldon Ocker to Sheldon Knocker. There's not actually a Sheldon Knocker, but that's how I referred to the character on the show The Big Bang Theory, because Sheldon would often run across the hallway in the apartment complex and knock on his neighbor Penny's door. Knock, 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 Penny. Knock, 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 Penny. Knock, 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 Penny! Sheldon would always try to warn Penny of impending danger, and believe it or not, in one episode, Sheldon posed as a representative from the Centers for Disease Control and insisted she rid herself of a defective piece of furniture. Well, the CDC over the last several months has been knocking on the door of the aforementioned Tony Tenpenny, a former Nashville councilman who referred to the COVID virus as a socialist hoax. Yes, he was the lead yesterday at Moran Monday. But Tenpenny would not listen or take heed. Knock, 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 Tenpenny, knock, 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 Tenpenny. Please listen, this is not a hoax, this is real and not a socialist plot. However, Tenpenny, whose ten pennies aren't worth a damn dime, recently died of COVID. And for all of you who think we on the left should have respect for the dead, well, no, we should not, because this asshole did not have respect for the living. I'm quite confident Tenpenny did not wear a mask, make any attempt to social distance, or do anything to adhere to the CDC guidelines. So now Tony Tenpenny is a knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Oh, dear, singing. What's that, Giraffrey? Giraffrey says, well, I calculated the relative value of Tenpenny and adjusted for inflation. He ain't worth a shit. And thank you, Jeffrey. Giraffrey. This has been Joey's Journal for a Trump-tanic Tuesday. The the 22nd day of September, with Giraffe adding up the cost of COVID. Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, the precise quote for that noted early 20th century eugenicist Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., courtesy of Flavio, three generations of imbeciles are enough. It comes from Buck versus Bell, a 1927 Supreme Court case that upheld a Virginia law that authorized the state to surgically sterilize certain mental defectives without their consent. Now, to be fair, Carrie Buck was white. She died in 1983. She was ordered to undergo compulsory sterilization for purportedly being feeble-minded. She wasn't. At most, she was poorly educated because she was poor. They performed the involuntary surgery upon her while she was an inmate at the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, and was done under the Racial Integrity Act of 1924, a eugenic statute put in place by the Virginia legislature. In order to ensure that the family could not reproduce, Carrie Buck's sister Doris was also sterilized when she was hospitalized for appendicitis, although she was never informed of the sterilization. She later married, and she and her husband attempted to have children. She did not discover the reason for their lack of success until 1980. Yeah. And on the other hand, a contrary opinion coming from Brother Deacon Asa. No, don't vote if you're a privileged white male like Bob. When the choice is between a middle-of-the-road lifelong civil servant and a flaming turd sandwich, the right thing to do if you're a member of the unicorn, the sparkle fart-propelled unicorn cavalry purity patrol is to burn it all down. I know. Jesus. Now, Lee in New York says, forced sterilization. Too bad that missed Donald Trump. Well, you know, they never got around to doing that to the people who had enough money to make sure it wasn't done to them. The vivid difference wrought by RBG, Scott in San Diego notes, Ruth Bader Ginsburg epitomized historic milestones. Anyone Trump installs on the Supreme Court represents gallstones. Yeah, galling indeed. Lorraine, Ohio, says, James in Illinois, home of the Lorraine Crane. Mm-hmm. I've heard of Lorraine's. Yeah, I bet you James has some experience probably with those pieces of equipment. I don't know what's wrong with our present nicknaming system, but Megan says they can be known as Big Gay Steve and Big Georgistan Steve. We could have the BGS duo. No, Megan, that's just going to make things more confusing. Good God, I'm just one humble little progressive liberal radio host. But it's Trump-tanic Tuesday. It is that day when we take note of those members of the Republican Party, those birthers, deathers, ninthers, tenthers, baggers, birchers, booger eaters, libertarians, trumpansies, maggots, etc. who best epitomized the notion of standing on the bridge of the Titanic, seeing, you know, the Titanic hit its iceberg at night. But for Trump-tanic Tuesday purposes, we will suggest that this happens in broad daylight and that the aforementioned Trump-tanic intellects will stand on the bridge, see the iceberg in all its glory, and say, flank speed, right for the, and put the pointy part of the boat right smack dab in the middle of the iceberg. We're gonna bust it up. And of course, we know what happens. But that being the case, I don't know how the lead story for this Trump-tanic Tuesday can't be Bishop Willard Romney. Yeah. Because Bishop Willard Romney, well, he made a weaselly little statement today saying that he would vote to confirm anybody that Donald Trump sent up as a nominee for the Supreme Court seat vacated by the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. As we were doing the math last night, it became apparent that Bishop Willard was part of that calculation. And so Bishop Willard declared, I recognize that we may have a court which has more of a conservative bent than it has had over the last few decades, but my liberal friends have over many decades gotten used to the idea of having a liberal court, and that's not written in the stars. Since when have we had a liberal Supreme Court? The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court before old Balls and Strikes Roberts was an old junkie named Rehnquist, and he was no liberal. Before that, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was a nasty old right-wing thug named Berger, and he was no liberal. We've had to cobble together little alliances to get anything decent out of the Supreme Court for working people, for women, for marginalized communities over the years. We've never had a chance to find out what it would be like to have a liberal Supreme Court. God, the very sound of Bishop Willard's voice.
The Constitution and precedent, as I've studied it. And
by the way, this is shitty audio. That's not me.
The side of the Constitution and precedent, as I've studied it. And make the decision on that basis.
Senator, you said that in your release that you would look at a nominee's qualifications. What qualifications are you looking for, and what would make you not consider someone that President Trump is putting forward?
Well, I think it's straightforward in terms of the qualifications you look for, which is someone who is an expert of the law, someone who has a record of fairness and judgment that you think is consistent with the law. I prefer choosing those folks who if you will, strict constructionists, meaning that they look at the law itself and the Constitution, as opposed to sort of looking into the sky and pulling out ideas that they think may be more appropriate than either the law or the Constitution. So I recognize that we may have a court which has more of a conservative bent than it's had over the last few decades. But my liberal friends have, over many decades, gotten very used to the idea of having a liberal court. And that's not written in the stars. And I know that a lot of people are saying, gosh, we don't want that change. I understand the energy associated with that perspective. But it's also appropriate for a nation which is, if you will, center-right, to have a court which reflects center-right points of view, which, again, are not changing the law from what it states, but instead following the law and following the Constitution.
Senator Romney,
bullshit. center-right country. Bullshit. What we have is a hard right Senate and a Republican Party that is hard right, that clings to power only because of constitutional flaws that allow the right wing to continue to bully the majority of this country. How is it that a center right country has something like a 79% approval for a woman's right to choose? Center right countries don't have that. God, do you remember? Oh, Bishop Willard, you fucking weasel. I knew we made a mistake when we... Well, you have to remember the history of the Romneys. Way, way, way back when Utah wanted to become a state, Utah becoming a state was predicated upon them ending the practice of Mormon polygamy. I got two wives, and it's mighty bigamy. Right. But the United States said to Utah, hey, you want to be a state? You got to stop letting every guy out there marry 18 women. Because, you know, polygamy in the Mormon faith goes back to when that old pervert and then Carnival Barker and huckster, Joseph Smith, got the hots for one of his followers' wives and suddenly got a message from Kolob that told him it was okay for him to take to wife anybody that he got a stiffy for. I mean, really, that's how it happens. The M-O-R paren M close paren paren O-N church doesn't like to acknowledge it, but it's pretty much the history. And so the Mormons went out to Utah and committed the Mountain Meadows Massacre and slaughtered some folks and genocided the fuck out of the locals and started to marry in the daylights out of folks. And then Utah wanted to be a state, and the United States government said, no. Not as long as y'all got all that polygamy going on. And so Utah, wanting to be a state, decided to end polygamy, and the people who were pissed off about it picked up bag and baggage and moved on. And by on, I mean Mexico. Yeah. The Romneys went to Mexico and stayed in Mexico. And George Romney, Bishop Willard's daddy, was born in Mexico. He was born a Mexican citizen. But things cooled off a little bit, and after a while, the Romneys decided that they were pining for the homestead back in Merca. And so they snuck back across the border. The Romney family, as rich as it is literally predicated on being undocumented immigrants. And so Bishop Willard is literally the son of, I think, an anchor baby. But more than that, and Steve from Georgia Stan wants to jump in for a second. We'll get there. I just want to finish this thought, because if ever there was a more useless human being in the United States Senate than Willard Romney, well, I mean, we could name check the entire Republican caucus, and they'd be as or more useless, too. But Bishop Willard puts it out there that he's some sort of moral paragon. And he ain't. He's just another money-grubbing Republican. But the best part of it all, simply because there's more singing involved, I know, just bear with me, it won't last long. There's this Mormon prophecy of the white horse. And for the longest time, especially, you know, back when we had that brown president, and America was teetering on the brink of disaster from the brownness of Barack Obama. Well, back in 2012, Bishop Willard stepped forward as the antidote to the brownness of Barack Obama and the threat his brownness posed to America's future. Because the White Horse prophecy in Mormon fairy tales says that at a time when the Constitution hangs by a thread, a white horse will rise up and go to Washington and save our country. And a whole bunch of Bishop Willard's Mormon followers said, "That's your white horse right there, your Willard Romney." And they did all that, the bishop, he's a fine white horse, he is. Well, here we are. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dead. The Constitution hangs by a thread. And the white horse is pulled up lame. You know what you do with a horse that's pulled up lame, right? Figuratively speaking. The old white horse, it ain't what it used to be, ain't what it used to be, ain't what it used to be. The old white horse, it ain't what it used to be, it's time to send it to the glue factory. Jesus, what a slime ball. What a skeeve. What a sad little money-grubbing puddle of fucking nothing Willard Romney is. And, of course, it's not playing at all well with members of the Horn Family Community Congregation. Our pal Mighty Mouse says, liberal blah blah who look to the skies, as quickly derived from the clip, but yes, coming from a Mormon moron bishop, can't have activist judges now, can we? Politicians in black robes ruling from the bench. What the fuck times infinity? I know. Wait a fucking minute, says Ron in Raleigh. Strict constructionist? Does that mean I go back to being 3/5 of a person? What the fuck is he talking about? Yeah, I know. Corporations are people, my friend. Human beings. Oh my God, says Darlene in Connecticut. Was Romney pulling that response to the reporter totally out of his ass? Well, from the brown quality of it, I would say the answer to that is yes. And thank you. Thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy just gave me a cowbell. Jeremy says, because Romney just pissed off the horn, you get a cowbell for I've got two wives and it's very bigamy. Thank you. It's an old joke, but a dandy. And it comes in handy anytime you're talking about Bishop Willard. White Horse Prophecy? Asks Lee in New York. Mr. Ed? Well, Mr. Mitt. Now, Senator Mitt, Steve says, it's just a drive-by, but I enjoy my conversations with Steve, and we haven't even heard from him much on Friday on the front porch of late, so this ain't going to be no drive-by, Steve.
Brother Bob.
How you doing, my friend?
Hey, thanks for letting me bounce in here, man. There's something that's been chaffing my ass for the last few days, and you've probably got an idea of what it is.
It's not the farmer's dog, is it? Because they've got a woman pitching it now, and she's not talking about the quality of its poo.
Yeah, how are your quality poos, man? Everything good?
You know, I try not to talk about that on the radio, but... You know.
We just were at dinner. What time is it?
Yeah, that was dinner in the Central Daylight Time Zone.
Okay, well, we're on a roll, man. To my point, Jesus Christ, the air media is so goddamned worthless. Mitch McConnell gets on there and says, we got a mandate 2018, the American people. They gave us 2 or 3 seats in the Senate. We got a mandate to do what we want. And not one goddamn talking head has said, first of all, the pickings were mighty slim for the Democrats in the Senate.
Yeah, it was almost mathematically impossible for the Democrats to take the Senate in 2018.
And 2018, not one of them said, well, Mitch, in the House, the Democrats gained 41 fucking seats. That wasn't just a mandate. They were yelling their fucking heads off, man. Not one of them has caught him on that, or any of these fuckers, man.
Well, that's because let it go, man. Let it go. Don't bottle that shit up. It's not good for you. It's rough on the gallbladder or something, I heard.
The pancreas. Yeah,
yeah, it's tough on the pancreas too, and the common bile duct. But they're millionaires, and so they're not prone to doing hard work. I mean, if you're there are lots of good, hardworking journalists out there. Very few of them are in the Washington press corps. Because when you get up in that thin oxygen, then access becomes the name of the game. And so if they'll stop and talk to you, the unspoken quid pro quo there is that you won't ask them any hard questions. There was a great example of that this morning on my Filthy Morning Habit. They pitched all show long the fact that they were going to be talking to H.R. McMaster, you know, former national security advisor to Donald Trump, whom Donald Trump said was an idiot and that was not up to the job and, you know, slimed him and sleazed him. He just took it. And finally, and it turns out he was there to hustle a book. That's the only reason he showed up.
That's usually the end game with all these bastards.
And it's so Wee Willie Geist. decided to ask him a hard question. Well, General, did you ever hear him refer to troops as suckers or losers? No, I didn't, and especially not with regard to our fallen heroes. No, I never did. Even though he said it in public. He said it in public, but somehow or another, H.R. McMaster managed not to hear that. And then we got some bromide about how we got to be careful about drawing washed-up old generals, war horses like me, into politics. Horse shit. You swore to uphold, to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and somehow or another, you can't bring yourself to speak truth to power. Oh, fuck him with a red-hot poker. Or white, and I do mean white-hot poker. Sorry, that was my little rant.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not even their wheelhouse. If I could think of it, you know that they had the question in their head. Why didn't they throw it out there? I mean, that's the first thing that hit me. In fact, I was so pissed off, I didn't get your red flag, don't watch any Sunday shows, because I was at the Walgreens, you know. First thing I did was text Bob. I'm like, Bob, is your head exploding over this shit? Are you watching this? Of course, I didn't know that you wasn't watching it. And I probably shouldn't have been either because it was bad for my blood pressure.
Well, but you did, and you took one for the team, and yeah. It's appreciated, Steve.
And then you got Lindsay saying, I changed my mind after the Kavanaugh hearings, after he blatantly said, I'm on record. Keep this tape. I'm on record. We will not nominate somebody in 2020 during an election year. Plain as fucking day. We got these bastards, every one of them, on record. But it doesn't matter. It does not matter.
Yeah, Steve Daines, too, in Montana.
Every one of them.
And he's in trouble. Yeah. So let's do the list again. We did it last night. Martha McSally, in trouble. Cory Gardner, in trouble. Steve Daines, in trouble. Thom Tillis, in North Carolina, in trouble. Lindsey Graham, in South Carolina, in trouble. Mitch is within striking distance. MJ Hager, in Texas, could conceivably take out John Cornholio. And we're up to like seven now. That would be plenty. And if we can get those, you know, because that would give us room for Joe Manchin to fuck up. We get those, Steve, and we can pass a bill. We can pass it in the House, make the number of Supreme Court justices 13, and send it over to the Senate, and then dare the likes of Tim Kaine and Joe Manchin to say no.
Yeah, they don't have any respect for the institution, obviously. And damn it, so what if it bounces back and forth? If that's the way it's got to be, so be it. Let it bounce back and forth.
Well, but it's not going to bounce back and forth. You can't make the number. You can't make the number on the Supreme Court smaller than what it is.
Did not know that. Interesting caveat.
Or at least you. I mean, okay, maybe you could do that. But you can't throw members off of the Supreme Court by any means except impeachment. So if we run it up to 13, the Republicans have to fucking live with it unless they get a majority in the House and Senate and they run it up to 19.
17.
17, 19, whatever. And then pretty soon you've got it. You know, remember, circuit courts have 30-plus members. So it's not like big courts are unheard of. And then they could change it because, okay, this is the next thing then. The court might see fit to change its rules of procedure to say that the first pass-through will be a panel of less than the entire full court. Just like it works in the circuit courts, you know, when you take a case to the Circuit Court of Appeals, initially your case is heard by a panel of three judges, and then when they rule, you can petition for a hearing en banc, and en banc means that the whole court hears it and votes on it. But it is not of right.
There you go.
But that's way out there.
Let me interject this, Bob. Our friend Roger brought up a really good point yesterday, and I don't know if we've ever verified this. Maybe somebody in the ad hoc Horn family can research this. If impeachment hearings are initiated, all Senate business must come to a halt. And God knows we got enough dirt on any of these bastards to, you know, just we can initiate impeachment hearings till 2022 if we want to.
Yeah. Because they have to be taken up.
Yep. And all other business must come to a halt. So I don't know if they've changed the rules or if they will change them on the fly. Probably they would do something sneaky like that, just change the rules with a simple majority vote, you know. I don't put nothing past these bastards, Bob. They have showed us who they – if we didn't know by now, it's like you've always said, when a zebra shows you his stripes –
It's a zebra. Or, more pertinently in this case, if it honks like a goose and it steps like a goose, it's a right-wing Republican fucking fascist.
Exactly. Well, Bob, thanks for letting me air that off my make that point, man. But I just wanted to know if anybody else has picked up on that. Because it's been screaming at me, and Washington Journal was this horror. It's a horror show anymore. This morning's question was for Republicans only.
Jesus.
And I'm trying to, I kind of remember what the question was. I'm having a mind blank. It was something to the effect that, I know what it was. Should we wait until after the election before we replace the seat? And I don't think I heard one call say, yeah, we should wait until after the election. Not one. Not one maggot would call and say, on principle alone, so we don't look like a bunch of goddamn liars, we should wait until after the election.
That's because looking like a bunch of goddamn liars does not matter to a Republican. That's because being a hypocrite is in their DNA. They don't care.
We can't turn this,
it is the naked,
we
it
can't
is the,
turn this thing around.
It is the naked exercise of power as a cudgel. That's the only thing that matters to a Republican. Political power. Country be damned, patriotism be damned, Constitution be damned. That's all that matters, Steve. Not yelling at you.
Consensus of the American people be damned. What do we got? 79% do not want Roe overturned? Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't matter, these bastards. They don't care, man.
And as I pointed out with Darlene last night, that's very close to the number of people who are irretrievably in the camp of Donald Trump and the number of Republicans who simply want to exercise brute power. There's a better way there's a better way of going about this. I mean, I was, because I think about these things all the time. I was, I do these little thought experiments in my head. That's why I love, like, walking that rail trail. I'm just completely by myself and my thoughts, and it's beautiful. And so I thought about a political candidate who, say, maybe showed up stumping in church. For some reason or another, well, I know what it was. I had seen a yard sign for our incumbent Republican Secretary of State, who's being opposed by a woman named Natalie Tennant, who has been a couple of terms as Secretary of State herself, and even ran for Senate against Shelley Moore Capito. And I was thinking, you know, how in a state that professes such abiding love for the precious little fetuses, how would you go about explaining to them your support for Roe v. Wade? And I came up with an answer. Tell me how this works for you. If somebody says,
sure,
do you support overturning Roe versus Wade? You know, maybe it's the preacher in the first gospel sharp tabernacle of politics and right wing hypocrisy, Baptist church. And the way you answer that, I think, is to say, well, we have to remember one thing in regard to Roe v. Wade. A woman's right to choose is a constitutional right. It's not a statutory right.
Exactly.
It's a constitutional right. Mm-hmm. And the problem with getting rid of constitutional rights is that it's kind of like Lay's potato chips. You can't just have one. Once you get rid of one constitutional right, it becomes easy to say, hey, there's probably some more we don't need. Hey, look, I mean, we can get rid of that old constitutional right about not having to quarter troops in your home, can't we? I mean, that's not even relevant anymore.
The barn door's open.
Let's get rid of that one, too. Okay, so we've gotten rid of a woman's right to choose and the right to not to have to quarter troops in your own home. How about the right against self-incrimination, the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination? Well, I mean, I'm talking to a church here, and y'all are all good Christian church people, and no good Christian church people ever violate the law, so you'd never really need that Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. So let's go ahead and get rid of that one, too. Well, that's three we've gotten rid of. How about the right to trial by jury? Well, again, you know, we're talking with good people here. Y'all are all Christians. You know, it says right there in the New Testament, St. Paul tells Christians don't take recourse to the courts of the secular state. So we can get rid of that one, too. That's four we've ditched. How about the right of the people to be secure in their persons, papers, and effects? That is, the right of the people not to have the cops come busting through your door for no reason at all, and instead they got to go and get a search warrant and do constitutional stuff. Well, again, y'all are good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical Christian and Christians, and y'all got nothing to hide. So, you know, why not just let the cops come through and nose around in your business? Okay, that's five we've gotten rid of now.
If you don't have anything to hide, you know.
Yeah, you got nothing to hide. So, you know, we'll get rid of that one too. And we've gotten rid of those other four because it was so easy to get rid of that one right of a woman to make decisions about the workings of her own body. But let's don't stop at five. Hell no. Some godless liberal gets to be president, and there's a godless liberal, commie, pinko, fascist, Rosicrucian, Freemason, Illuminati, learned elders of Zion Congress, and they decide that they don't like Fox News anymore. So we're going to get rid of the First Amendment ban on silence censoring and silencing the free press. But, well, I mean, there's always Onan, right? And things like Breitbart. So, you know, we don't really need Fox News that bad, so we can get rid of that. That's six.
It's the only place to get the truth is at Onan, didn't you know?
And then, you know, y'all don't really need to be here, do you? I mean, Jesus said, wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, there I am also. So, I mean, mom and dad, you're Christians, and you got children, you're raising them Christian. What do you need a church for? We can make it so the government can come in and just shut down churches for no reason whatsoever, can't we? Sure we can. And you know, okay, what if you want to have family dinner, and you want to have aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews and cousins and moms and dads all over for a big old family Sunday dinner? Well, why don't we just get rid of that that part of the First Amendment says that we're not going to, says that the government can't ban your right of freedom of association. Why don't we do that? Yeah, let's do that too. Of course, that'll just be like old home week here in West Virginia, because way back in the day, the coal company thugs could bust in on anybody's Sunday dinner and say that it was an illegal union organizing meeting. So we've already tried that. Might as well go back to it. Oh, and by the way, once we've done all of those things, because we started out with a woman's right to control the workings of her own body, that constitutional right, we can come for your guns too. So, instead of asking me about how I feel about Roe versus Wade, why don't you ask me how I feel about all of the freedoms contained in the Bill of Rights? Why don't you ask me about that? Because that's the real question that you're asking. You're not asking me about getting rid of one constitutional right. You're asking me about getting rid of all of them. And watch those little old blue-haired ladies sit there in the pews and watch the blood rise up in their faces till their faces are purple, and you can even see the purple through the 18 layers of fucking makeup they put on to go to church on Sunday. That's how you address, that's how you address getting rid of Roe v. Wade.
And here's a dirty little secret. Faith and I were chatting about this last night in the chat room. And it's not even a secret. Republicans get abortions too.
Sure they do. And absolutely. in particular, well-to-do Republicans know that abortion will always be legal in civilized states, so that when their precious little pumpkin makes a little mistake back behind the bleachers, well, they can take her on a spa weekend to California or Massachusetts or New York City. But it's the poor women, Steve, who are going to have to stay home,
right,
and bear their rapist's baby.
It arcs back to the divorce thing. At one time, I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg was saying that you could only get a divorce in Nevada at one time.
Yeah.
If you were of means, you know, you could schlep to Nevada. Other than that, you were stuck with your old man that was beating the hell out of you. So there's that. But Mr. Kincaid, I'm going to bounce, my friend. I appreciate you letting me get that off my chest.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Anytime you want to, Brother Steve. Absolutely. Yeah. Anytime you want to. You know you're welcome here.
I hope I didn't break the continuity of your show, but I just had to get that off.
Oh, no, there's other stuff to do, and there's other stuff. No, we will not hurt for content, and it will not be difficult at all to keep things moving.
But I'll try to make it a point to call back more often if you'd
like. Yeah, and don't be so damn quiet on Fridays either.
Okay.
you need to catch that new Farmer's Dog ad.
Yeah, there you go. Well, there's a reason for that, and I'll tell you about it via email.
All right.
Discuss it for another day. Good talking to you.
Hey, Bob. Well, let me ask you before you go. How's that Aircast going?
Oh, it's going good. Things are improving, and I should be whole again soon, real soon.
Good, good, good. All right, you take care of yourself, Steve, and give our best to little Twiggy and little Cletus and give our best, especially to Ms. Karen.
I'll do it, man. Take care, Bob.
All right, later. It's our buddy Steve from Georgia Stan jingling in. I understand, because sometimes it's damned infuriating watching these millionaires sit there with nothing better. What's your favorite color, Senator? Hey, God. Yeah. Okay, so Steve asked earlier, hey, can I jump in on this too? Go, Steve. It's the Steve and Steve hour.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're good.
Any wind in the background?
Not at the moment.
Okay, cool. I'm going to completely disagree with you on how to address Roe. Or, no, address abortion. And here's why. Like it or not, those other rights that you mentioned are enumerated. And it's too easy for somebody to say, yes, but it says right there, I have a right to speech and religion and all that kind of mishigas. I think the way you do it is this. You first of all ask the question, what did Roe do? And too many people think Roe legalized abortion. It did not. What Roe said was that within the first trimester of a pregnancy, a woman had a right to privacy to discuss all options with her doctor, including abortion. And it was a constitutional right to do so. So it fell under right to privacy.
Right, as established in Griswold.
Correct. So then what you say to these folks is, getting rid of Roe, and this will blow their mind, getting rid of Roe will not get rid of abortion. It won't make abortion illegal. It'll still exist in plenty, and it'll still be a right, whether statutorily or constitutionally, in a number of states. And then you say this. You say, if your goal is to make abortion rare, a last option, to make it not happen as much as possible, then we need to ask ourselves, why do people want to get one? And I understand, frankly, my own personal view is, and I think I've actually said this before, I have a serious issue with abortion. However, as a male, I don't think I have any, I don't have any right to weigh on the issue other than to give my opinion. To try to encourage a woman, if a woman came to me and said, Steve, what do you think? I would tell her. But beyond that, I don't feel any privilege, I'll say in this case, to opine on the issue of what a woman should do, unless she asks me. So we get back. Why would a woman feel the need to do so? And let's address that. If the goal is to make them rare and not happen very often, we can have that discussion. Repealing Roe won't make them illegal. And I think something like that would actually blow an awful lot of people's minds. And I'm not just saying people in red states. I think, you know, and let me digress for a moment. There was some nitwit who wrote an article for CNN about Roe, and he put in there that Roe, which legalized abortion, and I wrote the guy back. I actually tweeted the guy or emailed him. I said, Roe didn't do that. So do your fucking homework, asswipe. There's nothing I hate worse than journalists opining on things when they're clearly wrong. But I digress. So why don't we address those issues? Why they need them? and what can we do to make them not happen as much? And then what you do...
Well, I think the data on how you make it not happen as much is plain as day.
Empower women. But realizing, and I'm using the paradigm of the conversation, what I'm using is the context that you proposed was going to the church and talking to those people.
Well, my hypothetical was that you've been invited to the church and, you know, they laid a trap.
Okay.
And, you know.
Okay. And here you pull out the old Machiavelli, Sun Tzu philosophy, and you say this. The fact is those with means who, you know, we'll call them rich folks, wherever they are going to be able to go to wherever it's legal and have one. Make it an issue of class. And I think if you explain it that way, then all of a sudden it takes the focus off of Roe and off of those issues and makes it a class issue and makes it an issue of, if you want to make it a last resort, address how we do that, because a repealing Roe will not make it illegal. And in fact, the only people who will get them, you know, and the way you explain it, and I'm thinking a West Virginia, and I don't mean this to sound, it's going to sound awful, and I don't mean it to sound that way. You know, pastor, you know, whoever, in little in wherever West Virginia, in, you know, wherever little community church, make it an issue of us versus them, class, and demonize the rich. They're always going to have them.
Yeah, demonizing back when this state was much more unionized, demonizing the rich worked. It doesn't anymore, Steve, because they're all sitting there in the pews, one lottery ticket away from being the rich. Every Wednesday and every Saturday, they go and they buy a Powerball ticket, even though, you know, gambling, Jesus, all of that.
Right.
They go and they buy a Powerball ticket, and they check it the following morning, and they realize that they are once again temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
Okay. But you understand where I'm coming from.
Well, I do, but that position is also kind of dangerous, because if overturning Roe has utterly no effect on abortion, then why do we even care? Why do we care about Amy Coney Barrett or whoever Florida woman, whatever Florida woman's name is?
Well, I think there's something we need to understand. They're not going to do that. They're never going to overturn Roe.
Now you're getting close to a real politic explanation that I've made for coming up on 17 years.
Yeah.
Everybody of all the people in this country who want to see abortion come to an end, who want to see abortion recriminalized, the last people in the world that want to see that happen is the anti-abortion industry.
Yeah.
Because the anti-abortion industry is just about the only thing they have left to really, really bring their voters out from behind the baseboards come election time.
And to pull in the Benjamin.
And it pulls in a shit ton of money.
Yeah.
It is an anti-abortion, as I said, and I don't just throw words around, industry.
Yeah. 100%. I 100% agree with you. It's that they're never going to repeal it, or are never going to overturn it. They're going to narrow it, and again, and we've also talked about this. The other fact is that Roe is not the law of the land when it comes to abortion rights. Casey is.
Yeah.
But they're never going to do that. They can. What they can do is they can narrow it. They can make it as useless as possible, and they can say any number of things are not undue burdens, which is
the standard
that and who articulated it in Casey?
Kennedy, wasn't it?
Nope. Sandra Day O'Connor.
Ah.
So, but they're never. But that's the fact. So, in terms of again, I'm not a woman, so I can kind of afford to not be as concerned about it. But I, on another political note, I suspect. Well, I don't want to say that, but there's an awful lot of people, women in this country, if Roe were overturned, would affect. But there's an awful lot of people it wouldn't affect. It wouldn't affect people on either the coasts, in the more populous states, the more democratic states. I mean, people in New York, it wouldn't affect. Because it's been.
Well, I mean, we can tick that list off. It's not going to affect people in California, Oregon, or Washington. It's not going to affect people in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, probably Vermont, New Hampshire. Well, maybe New Hampshire, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, maybe Delaware. After that, on the East Coast, yes, it's going to have an effect down to Florida.
Right.
Down to Florida.
Right, down to Florida. So I think I fear that the focus on Roe, and let's be honest here, Bob, people on the folks on the left oh my God, they're going to overturn Roe. That, people on the left, probably not to the same extent, also raise money on that.
Sure. Just like people in the LGBTQ community, organizations there, raise money on, oh my God, Amy Coney Barrett will take steps toward overturning Obergefell.
Right.
Everything is on the table with these punks.
But I think it's all about money. And look, and this is all I'll say on that. There's something else I want to talk about, particularly the Supreme Court in general. If they really want, if the GOP and all these conservatives really wanted to do something about Roe, they had, since 2000, the number of years that the GOP has controlled everything, which would have been 2003 to 2006. There was only a couple years, I think, where Bush didn't control the legislature, or at least one house. And then from 2010 to just recently, the GOP controlled everything. So if they really wanted to do something, they could have. They didn't.
Yeah.
Because they want the issue. And I would argue that the gay marriage issue hasn't really been the big fundraising boogeyman, because it happened and shit didn't change. And I think people looked around and they didn't really notice any difference. And
yeah, all the Chick-fil-A's haven't been shut down. I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hobby Lobby is still selling useless handicraft crap.
Right. And I think to a large extent, and maybe I'm just wrong because I don't live in real America anymore, but my hunch is that it was kind of one of those things that people went all, oh shit, let me hold our breath when they finally do it, and nothing really happened. And,
let me ask you this question, Steve. To what extent is Roe sort of a mnemonic for all the other wickedness that a 6-3 white wing court could accomplish? That's the Roe gets people's attention because it impacts fully half or more of the population of this country. But everything is on the damn table. I mean, let's see here. Let me throw
Lochner.
Sure. I mean, Lochner is a fetish object.
Yeah.
For the right wing. Privity of contract and all of that silly horse shit.
Mm-hmm. And frankly, that's the stuff that would really affect the working class and poor people. The problem is it's too kind of esoteric. Whereas Roe, the right wing has been very good at framing that as this: you want to kill babies and we don't.
You know, you guys want to kill fetuses and we don't.
And we don't.
But they also don't want to feed fetuses. They don't want to house fetuses. They don't want to clothe fetuses, you know, after they're not fetuses anymore and they're actual viable living human beings.
No, I get it. But the abortion issue to an awful lot of people is black and white. You kill babies or you don't. And put fetus and all that kind of stuff aside, because the people I think who care most about quote unquote overturning Roe or ending abortion are the people who see it as killing babies. If you remember what Fuckwad said in his tweet yesterday after upon RBG's passing, and you read it last night. It's killing baby. Killed 30 million babies. That's the guy, Doug Collins.
Murdered.
Things like Lochner. Well, you know, Lochner said that you aren't allowed, that you can, that your employer. I mean, really, what does Lochner say is that it came up with the fiction that there is, it's contract. You have a right to contract with your employer to work however much you want.
And the state cannot interfere in that contractual relationship.
Right.
Because because of the privity involved.
Right. Yeah. But the real, you know, as anybody who has been an employee anywhere is not in a union knows, it's not, each side does not come to the table with equal power, which is why something like Lochner is so absurd, because for every one company which employs 50 people, there are 50 people looking for a particular job. So if you don't agree to work 60 hours a week, well, fuck you. Okay.
Well, yeah, and of course that exists in any number of states, in what is referred to as at-will employment.
Mm-hmm.
And the fiction was created, and it is that, a fiction, and a ludicrous one, an absurd one at that, this notion that, well, the employer and the employee, thanks to at-will employment, is on the same footing. 'Cause
you don't
got to work there, and you can quit for any reason or no reason, and your employer can fire you for any reason or no reason. Of course, you know, the corporation, the employer, whatever, they're not going to have trouble keeping the power on or maybe keeping a baby fed or in diapers, but the employee is. And it's like I said, it's an obnoxious fiction. You know, I mentioned that I took that little walk down that rail trail today, Steve. Let me just, within that context, let me just share a little bit of the history of that. It is a narrow gauge railroad track of about 2.5 miles length. And it was built by a man who today would be deemed a billionaire. His name was William Nelson Page. And he was a swell of the billionaire class. And what he wanted to do was build a railroad without the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad knowing about it. He wanted to build a railroad into the New River Gorge that would take coal to Norfolk for sale and open up the New River coal fields and free him up from paying the freight that CNO charged. And he did it.
Okay.
He built a damn railroad, and at one point in time, the George Washington, I think that was what it was called. Maybe not. But it was known as the richest little railroad in the world.
He was the Tucker of his time.
And his mansion sits at the top of the hill, and he had a spur that came all the way to his front door. And his mansion was built by men desperate for work, mm-hmm. paid pittance wages, and who sweated and bled and died making him richer. And that narrow gauge,
really? I'm surprised.
That narrow gauge railroad track extends about 2.5 miles from town down to where Mill Creek empties into the New River. And its ruins are there along the way for those who bother to take a look at and to look for them. There are mine drift mouths. There are the timber beam ruins of the old water tank still stand. Mm-hmm. And everyone who worked on any of that project worked on it because they were afraid of their families starving. And if they dared to mutter the word union, there were gun thugs who were more than willing to come in and put a bullet behind a few conveniently placed ears and make sure that union talk went away.
Sure.
And William Nelson Page never worried about where his next meal was coming from. He knew where it was coming from. It was being shipped in on his train. But everybody else suffered at, I keep using the word pittance wages, because that's how he got richer. And yet today, walking that track, well, the railroad's gone. And the mines are gone. And I stood there looking at the ruins. And there's actually one. There's a mine mouth there, and carved in stone, above the opening, it says, "Mill Creek Colliery, 1921." As if it was going to last forever. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't help thinking about, I think it's Shelley, who wrote Ozymandias. Are you familiar?
Listen, you are the literature English.
Well, it's the poem. It's persons. The poem he writes about seeing a pair of legs, great monumental legs, sitting alone in the desert where the wastes of sand stretch away as far as the eye can see. And he talks about how there's a plaque there, and on the plaque it says, and amidst all this desolation, and what this actually was the ruins of Ramses the II, by the way, the pharaoh. But on the plaque it reads, "I'm Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair." And of course, at the time that Ozymandias had it written, he meant no one is greater than me. Give up. Don't even try. But by the time Keats or Shelley or whichever one of those romantics is writing about it in the early 19th century, it is a metaphor for the futility of human ambition and the futility of wealth and the futility of self-aggrandizement. And I thought of the very same thing as I stood among those ruins. Because it's all gone. You know what's still there? The water that has sung like a choir over the course of tens of millions of years as it made its way down drop and carved away shale and carved away slate and carved away coal until there's nothing left but positively polished sandstone slabs. And that's reality. Mm-hmm. That's reality. But try explaining that to somebody like, say, a Bishop Willard Romney, who spends all his time worrying about getting more money. And whether it was Shelley or Keats, and I don't remember, their pal Wordsworth wrote another poem, 1803, 1804. It's even before the Industrial Revolution begins in England, in earnest. Mm-hmm. And he said, "The world is too much with us. We lay waste our days, coming and going, getting and spending." And he understood.
Sure.
And there, and everything we're talking about, because yeah, you're right to a certain extent. It is not just Roe v. Wade, but you know what? For every woman in this country, I'm not going to remonstrate if that's what they focus on, because that is what matters to them.
No, I agree.
But this will be, as you point out, a rapaciously capitalist court that will destroy the world for a fucking nickel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I completely agree.
And by the way, the name of the railway, thank you, Scott, was the Virginian.
By the way, hi, Scott. I'm trying to check in on Scott periodically because I worry about him.
Well, he tried to check in earlier, but you got in first.
Oh, okay. Now I want to talk about the thing with RBG and the filling of the court vacancy.
Okay.
I'm going to go back a couple, not a couple years, but let me just say this. What the GOP is doing doesn't bother me. The only thing that sort of bothers me is the hypocrisy. But look, you remember the argument that they said in 2016 as well, the American people should be able to weigh in on, you know, who gets to appoint the justice and yada, yada, yada. And my view is this. When the American people or the Electoral College votes for a president, that president's term of office begins on January 20th, the following year at noon, and ends 4 years hence on January 20th at 11:59 a.m. At that point, you know, a president's term is 4 years, not 3.5, not 3.75, it's 4 years. So 4 years ago, or 3.5 years ago, when the Electoral College voted for Donald Jesus Trump, they weighed in on who got to choose Supreme Court justices for 4 years. That was the correct argument in 2016. That is the correct argument now. What Democrats need to stop doing is whining about it. Like it or not, this is what the president gets to do for 4 years from the day he or she takes office.
Unless he's 3/5 of a president.
Correct. The remedy is not to piss and moan about it and to say, well, he shouldn't do it in an election year and he shouldn't do it 40 days before an election. Look, as far as I'm concerned, a president is well within his rights to nominate a Supreme Court or anybody to any federal court up until 11:58 a.m. January 20th.
Right.
We'll leave office. And this garbage about, well, the hypocrisy, and we need to call out their fuck that. They don't care. So rather than worrying about hand-wringing and pearl-clutching and hemming and hawing about hypocrites, they don't care. What we need to start worrying, what we need to start thinking is, okay, he's going to get a third justice. It's going to happen. Instead of pissing and moaning and hemming and hawing about, you know, trying to call out the Republicans' hypocrisy, I mean, clearly, like I said, they don't care. Mitch McConnell doesn't care. Lindsey Graham doesn't care. So what it strikes me is that Democrats need to grow the hell up and say, fine. You have the Senate, you have the presidency, great. This is what you get to do. We don't like it, but this is the presidential privilege, shall we call it. Move beyond that. The question then needs to be, okay, what do we do now? And what we do now is we do two things. Sure, there's nothing wrong with fighting like hell to gum up the works, to try to keep it from happening. That's great. Doing whatever we can to keep it from happening. But stop this bullshit crying about, well, look how close it is to an election, and, well, you said this, and you're being a hypocrite. Forget about that. They're going to be hypocrites. We need to understand that that's baked in the cake for a Republican, at least in this day and age. Putting aside the past and what we might think of the past, that doesn't matter at all. So we have two choices. Fight it and fight like hell, as far as I'm concerned. Fight like hell. I'm not so sure that impeachment doesn't hurt politically in the long run, but fight like hell, whatever, to keep it from happening. But when it happens, quit pissing and moaning about this, the hypocrisy. Like I say, I've said it several times, they don't care. So what do we do next? We stack the court. And I only bring this up specifically to talk about the situation that we're in. But those who are Democrats, liberals, progressives, whatever, anyone to the left of the center on the political spectrum, stop playing by their rules. Stop talking about hypocrisy. They don't – it doesn't affect them. When we play on – you know, and this is, again, from the art of war. When you play on your opponent's field, you lose every time. Great. You know what? You're going to play the GOP, the right wing, they're going to play on their own field. Great. Run up and down your own field. Score your own touchdowns. We on the other side, we're going to do whatever we can to get our own way. And for those who say, well, you know, who's to say that they won't do it if they get into power, that's the way it goes. Until Democrats understand, Bob, it's power.
Sure it is. Nope. Sure it is, Steve. And I don't think the howls of what hypocrites the Republicans are is in any sense an attempt to shame them. Anybody who is that close to them knows that they cannot be shamed. You cannot shame the shameless. But you have to continue to drive the point home. You have to keep playing that clip of Lindsey Graham and Steve Daines saying, wow, this is time. Yeah, we won't do it. We won't do this again. For the sake of the American people. It's like what I was saying last night. And then, lo and behold, David in South Carolina, Stan, sent us the quote from Jamie Harrison, where he was essentially saying the same thing. You know, Jamie Harrison said to Lindsey Graham via Twitter, "My granddaddy used to say to me that a man's word is his bond. Well, Lindsey, your word is trash."
Trash.
Okay. And so you have to keep hammering on that, because you might actually change a mind or two. And you're right. The way it's set up right now, this is going to happen before the election. And Chinless Mitch is betting the farm on the idea that it will work to his advantage, not his disadvantage. He thinks it might actually save Martha McSally. He thinks it might actually save Cory Gardner and Steve Daines and Thom Tillis. That's the wager that he's making. And so you have to keep hammering on the hypocrisy, so that even if there's anybody who is not a diehard flag waving, Yeti cooler shooting, Nike tennis shoe burning, Trump hat wearing maggot, might have second thoughts. If he'll break his word on this, what else will he break his word on? And remember, like I said, down there in poor old beat down, broken down South Carolina, all they gots is the honor. And they're so in love with the honor that they were willing to let their children be slaughtered 150 years ago for it. Mamas sent their little teenage babies out into hails of Union gunfire for honor. So it has to stay front and center. It has to be hammered on. I mean, it would be nice maybe if somebody would see Mitch McConnell in the street and haul up a big old bronchial bivalve and plant it right in the middle of his face. But
I agree with you. I think I was probably incomplete. I agree with you that essentially what you're saying is what I'm saying. It's probably two sides of the same coin. The Democrats need to fight a two-front war. And a two-front war is exactly what you're saying. That's where you appeal to voters. But at the same time, don't think that that's going to move any of the people in power. And you continue to plan to pack the court.
Yeah. And of course, Ron and Raleigh pointed out a little bit ago that he said Grandpa Joe has said he already said he opposes packing the court. Well, again, the time with everybody except Donald Trump and other Republicans, the times make the president. And so whatever his past is is not really relevant to this discussion. It is what the Constitution requires for its own salvation.
Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you, Joe can say that right now, but after he's elected and there are Democratic majorities in both houses and people start lighting up the switchboards and say, do this, do this, do this, he's going to, you know, that's the way you force him. And I'm channeling my inner Scott here, my little optimism. That's what pushes him. Because if it's overwhelming, that gives him the cover to say, look, I mean, worst comes to worst, he doesn't – what is it? He doesn't – what is that? Oh, that's a pocket veto. Never mind. He signs it. Hey, I don't want to do this, but the people have spoken.
And I admit that I do in I do engage in and enjoy a little bit of fantasy from time to time. And one of the things that I'm thinking I've been thinking about is that you remember how no Republican would give Merrick Garland a meeting?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how fucking rude was that?
Oh, it's just it's.
But it's who they are. Okay, it's just who they are. It would be fun if there was a senator, a Democratic senator, with enough nerve to say, "Oh no, fuck no! I'll take a meeting with Amy Coney Barrett or Florida woman. I'll take a meeting with her, and then give her the meeting, bring the media in, have the cameras rolling, and look her straight in the eye and say, 'You suck. You have no honor about you, or you would not accept this nomination. You know damn good and well you have no right to it. You know that you, supposedly a constitutional scholar, know damn good and well that a president who has already been impeached should not be allowed to appoint so much as a goddamn garbage man. You suck. And I'm going to spend the rest of my career here. I am going to be like Cato the Elder. Every time I get up, the first thing he said was Carthago delenda est. Carthage must be destroyed. Every time I get up, I'm going to say Amy Coney Barrett sucks or Florida woman sucks. And I'm going to go at it until you can't stand it anymore. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, I just had a tear in my eye. That would be fantastic. But you see where I'm getting is that Democrats need to stop with this. You know, we need to. I wish that we didn't have to play. That we didn't have to play on their turf. That there could be some sort of civility.
Well, but we're back in the mid 19th century now, and there's no such damn thing. And the only thing we're missing is a duel every other day across the line in Maryland,
or a guy bringing his cane into the old Senate chamber and beating his opponent. I wish I wish it weren't only, okay, we're going to screw you until you come into power and then you go ahead and screw us. The notion of collegiality in politics is, I suspect, not, that's a new thing. That's not how politics has ever been practiced up until the last few years. And I'm okay with that. Because I don't give a for me personally, I don't care. I don't care how we get to, name any policy position that I want to see win. I don't care how we get there. I don't care who we have to, what we have to do to get there. When you're growing up, you're like, the ends justify the means. That's really not a good thing. Blah, blah. And I'm like, I've gotten to the point where I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I have some limits. But my concern is making sure people are able to eat and able to live and able to have a job and able to have a family and support that family and go to the doctor.
Yeah, you got to meet the Maslowian hierarchy of needs before you start worrying about window treatments.
Because, Bob, until if we don't do that, we're nothing but animals.
Well, I mean, that's certain. I feel that way about. I've felt about that way about Republicans for a long time. But let me shift gears on you just a hair, and mm-hmm. and ask a question of you because I know you're Roman Catholic, and you have tried to
marginally.
But you've tried to take your faith seriously and live it. But the fact of the matter is, Roman Catholics in this country are, according to one statistic I read, somewhere around 21% of the American population.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem fair?
21%, which would be what? 60 odd million?
Yeah.
Um, I guess, you know, and as an aside, counting Roman Catholics is a little bit different than counting non-Catholics, because once a Catholic, always a Catholic, at least in the count of Catholics, whereas your more evangelical Protestants, certainly, it can be more fluid, because there is no official Pentecostal church or official, at least not in the same way, Baptist church. But putting that aside, yes. Hello?
Yeah. Okay. So, no. the reason I ask is because if Roman Catholics make up about 20% of the religious population of America, or 20% of America, if we take that as a legitimate number, then why is the church so wildly overrepresented on the Supreme Court? I mean, Sotomayor is nominally Roman Catholic.
Right.
Old Balls and Strikes, Catholic.
Right.
Thomas, you know, and he's one of those weirdo Catholics, you know, the barbed wire and the hair shirts.
I didn't think he was Catholic.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. No, that's Ann's boy, Neil. He converted from Roman Catholicism to Catholic light. And of course, you know, Brat is Roman Catholic and, you know, proves it by virtue of the fact that he has allegations of sexual abuse against him.
Mm-hmm.
The church is wildly overrepresented on the court, and I'm trying to figure out how it is that both on the Democratic and Republican side, they keep rising to the top, because it certainly has not been that way always.
Well, particularly in this country, I would agree with you. I mean, this country, like it or not, there is a rather strong anti-Catholic strain throughout American history.
Well, it was born of the disdain that the framers had for Holy Mother Church, by virtue of the wickedness that Holy Mother Church had wrought in Europe, and particularly in England.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, let's do remember that the Jesuits sent an assassin squad to try to bump off Elizabeth the First.
Mm-hmm. Going to your question, I think some of it has to do with this. I think you could argue that Jewish folks are overrepresented. Is Elena Kagan the only Jewish person on the court?
Yeah, I think so.
So that's one of nine, which is 11%. I'll bet our population is not 11% Jewish in this country.
Probably not, but I don't have nearly the problem that I do.
No, I agree.
Because it seems like we have a tendency to run toward not just Roman Catholics on the court, but the weird ones.
Well, I think what
you know, the cranks, the cranks that oppose Vatican II and things like, you know, all that Mel Gibson shit.
You know, I understand Society of Saint Pius X. If anybody wants to look at that, look up that Bishop Lefebvre in Switzerland. But anyway, I think part of it has to do with this. I'm going to contrast, at least how I see it, Protestantism and at its base, and Catholicism. Catholicism, whether you like it or not, has a very strong social justice base, going back to, I believe, the encyclical was called Rerum Novarum. And out of Rerum Novarum came things like a person's right, or people's right to organize. And I think by necessity, because of the anti-Catholic strain in the U.S., there was an activist tendency within Catholicism, and in addition, that Catholicism was an immigrant-based faith group, Italians, Irish, and even now Hispanics. And given that it's Italian and Irish in particular, it was a very working class oriented religion, particularly in the U.S. But it's always active, you know.
Yeah, I understand. I understand what you're getting at. I was thinking in particular a while back when the Supreme Court struck down no government funds for religious schools statute. Said it was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Not that long back. And of course, the Catholics on the Supreme Court said, "Well, you know, clearly this is a matter of anti-Catholic bias," when that was just a blatant lie. The reason that law was enacted was to be in accordance with the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause. It didn't say Catholic schools can't have any federal funds. It said church schools can't have any federal funds or any government funds. Because that was deemed at the time, and the law was really old, it was deemed to be violative of the separation of church and state. The state should never be in the business of propping up religious institutions. Never, ever, 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 ever. But the Catholics on the Supreme Court said, "Oh, clearly this is anti-Catholic bias." Bullshit.
Well, I'm not defending. I'm not. Whatever, but what I will say about that is there are a number of Catholic parishes and schools that served inner city poorer communities who could not afford to go to private school, Catholic school, that didn't charge people, kids, families, for that. And it may very well be that given that fact, that's why they may have seen it that way. The other thing, what I was going to say earlier, before was, think of this, you know, and I don't want this to be, you know, church night.
No, we'll save that for tomorrow.
Okay, but no. If you think of the theology, a very simple. Here's how I'll describe it. In Catholicism, you do not hear this. You don't hear my personal Lord and Savior.
No, that's a bunch of baloney cooked up by the.
Evangelicals. Yeah, it's a very evangelical.
It's my Jesus and nobody else's. He's my Jesus and you can't have him.
Right. Whereas in Catholicism, it's much more parish, community oriented. I mean, if you think about the primary sacrament is about people gathering for a meal, the Eucharist. And I think that is why you tend to find more Catholics, because the focus is on affecting the community. And when you have people who and whether or not they're on the right or the left, they're not as insular as, or at least traditionally, as Protestants have been. I mean, think about it. You know this, Bob. That if I mean, before old racist white supremacist Jerry Falwell and his amoral majority, the notion of Baptists in particular, particularly Southern Baptists, being involved in politics was just a no-no.
Yeah, that was deep in the DNA of the Baptist Church.
Yeah, it was don't get involved. And it was only at that time is when that began to change. Okay, fine, that's since then. Whereas with Catholic social teaching, it was the complete opposite. And it dovetailed very much with the, in Catholic theology, the notion of creating the kingdom on earth, that Catholics are co-creators of the kingdom. So they had a part to play in feeding the hungry and that type of stuff. And I think that focus, being more involved in the community from the very beginning, as very much built, that's in the DNA of Catholic teaching, that I think that could very well be an explanation as to why they're overrepresented, because they were the ones who were disproportionately active in whichever movement, whichever side of the spectrum. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that is an explanation that I could see. And the other thing too is think of the Talmud in Judaism. You have the Talmudic perspective where it's study. It's not just Jews don't typically just read the Bible and that's it. They study it. And they look at the rabbis, and they look at the commentary and the traditions over centuries.
Yeah, the Talmudic tradition, it always reminds. I always thought there was kind of a similarity between the Talmudic tradition and, for instance, you mentioned earlier Sun Tzu's The Art of War. Well, if you read The Art of War, there's one sentence by Sun Tzu, and there's 50 pages of people commenting on that one sentence.
On commenting on it.
That's kind of like the Talmud. I got to share this though, because Angelo just wrote in from the People's Republic of the Bronx. Former Catholic here. According to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, we all belong to the body of Christ, if I remember correctly. Through His grace and God's mercy, we are one with the Church.
I actually have a copy of the latest Catechism. He may be quoting from the Baltimore Catechism. I don't know. Baltimore Catechism was the catechism before John Paul II revised it. I don't know. I couldn't tell you if that's an actual catechetical teaching. I really didn't want to get into this, but do you understand? And I think Catholicism is very much. Catholicism is not a, it's not a sola scriptura faith. It's very Talmudic in the way that it looks at the Bible and the way that the church operates. And I think that lends itself to people who are into studying. I mean, think about it. Whatever you think about the Jesuits and the Dominicans and all these places, look how many colleges and universities and schools that various orders have set up, and in a lot of those places they don't charge. There is no tuition. There's a very good school in New York called Regis. I know a number of friends of mine who went to Regis Catholic School for boys. There's no tuition. You get in, you get to go. How many Baptist schools are there?
The one that comes to—it's not Baptist, but the one school that comes to mind most famous for that is Berea College in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. If you're admitted, mm-hmm. you're in, and you come out with no student loan debt, and you have to work a job the whole time you're there.
Sure, but the point but you understand what I'm getting at is I think there is an underlying, you know, I remember when I was in college, lo these many moons ago, where I never will forget this conversation. There was this classmate of mine who lived in the dorm room next to me, and she and I had a really interesting conversation one night. And I remember she said to me, "Do you hate Jews?" She was Jewish. She says, "Do you hate Jews?"
Oh.
And it was the oddest question, and I my first thought in the back of my mind was, it was just very odd. I mean, I didn't grow up Catholic, so I didn't have a lot of that Catholic disdain for Jewry. And I remember thinking to myself, should I? I don't. And she says to me, if I had met the Jewish people here, I would hate Jews. But she I don't know why I'm telling this that particular aspect, but what she did tell me is that in Judaism, within Jewish families, education is everything. Education, 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 yeah. Education.
And it's the case with almost every non-mainstream culture. You hear the same thing in the Asian community, you hear the same thing in the Indian community. India's in Asia, but you get the point.
Yeah.
Chinese, Japanese, Korean. I remember it became a little bit of an inside joke when I was a kid. There was a Korean boy who lived in our neighborhood, and you know, we'd go from door to door, "Hey, can so and so come out and play?" You know, after school and everything. And when you got to Eddie's house, it was, "Can Eddie come out and play?" "No." Now we're talking about, you know, "No, Eddie study. Eddie's going to be a doctor." "Ah, come on, he's six." But didn't matter, six, eight, ten. Right. "No, Eddie study. Eddie's going to be a doctor."
Right. But I use this to illustrate, you know, your question. Getting back to your question, why do there seem to be a disproportionate number of Catholics on the court? And I think part of that has to do with what I just mentioned.
Yeah, this idea that they have a superior educational rigor.
I don't want to say superior. It's built into. You know, and that also, I mean, think of it this way. It also comes with, you know, when you have a 2,000-year, for all intents and purposes, we'll just say half of that, you know, going from the 1066, the Great Schism, till now. That's still 1,000 years of tradition built up. And when you have these monks and brothers and orders that come up that have these schools where they teach this stuff to kids, particularly boys, who then become men, that rigor,
and it's a like, and it's a, and it's a and it's a patriarchal structure anyway. So the boys who become the men are going to replicate it again and again and again and again. And you know, there are all these different orders, and I'm fairly conversant with the history of the church, and it's not something, and you know, it's not particularly impressive when you get down into the nuts and bolts of it. But there's a film out there that is one of my absolute favorites. It's one of my Desert Island films, and it's The Mission.
Oh yeah,
that shows the disconnect between the political power brokering church and the priests on the ground who are actually trying to do the work of poor suffering Jesus.
Yeah. Who are the ones? And look, I'm not going to defend the violent proselytizing, but again, if you look in a lot of particularly indigenous peoples, communities throughout Central and South America. And again, let's put aside the proselytizing stuff. There was a friend of mine my friend Bill who went to Regis would talk about that it was the Jesuits who went who were the ones who offered a lot of indigenous people and people in small communities throughout Central and South America an education that they otherwise
they went from being a group of assassins among other things to being the most rigorous educational arm of the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, there's one of my favorite jokes. It's so esoteric. Is the Benedictine and the Jesuit who are sitting down having lunch, and they're talking about their relative orders, and the Benedictine says to the Jesuit, "So, why was it you were founded?" And the Jesuit says, "Well, in the beginning, we were founded to wipe out the Protestant heresy." How about you? And the Benedictine said, "Well, we were founded to wipe out the Albigensian heresy." Mm-hmm. And the Jesuit says, "So, basically, there's not much difference between us." The Benedictine looks at him and says, "Don't see a lot of Albigensians, do you?"
Yeah.
I love that one.
Yeah. And, you know, I find the Jesuits very interesting because you have this very, very – and if you look at any history of St. Ignatius Loyola, who was a former Spanish soldier, they went from being that almost militaristic to – not almost militaristic, but militaristic. You know, the Jesuits were like the defenders of the papacy.
Yeah.
Whereas eventually they became like, if you think of like the Jesuits, which came up with the, in South America, liberation theology.
Yeah.
Were the bane of the hierarchy.
Yeah, like the ones that Pope Frank turned his back on in Argentina.
Yeah, right. But getting back to your question about why the disproportion, I don't know.
Obviously. Well, we do have a theory. We have a theory put forward here. Angelo, again, from the People's Republic of the Bronx, says it has more to do with the colleges and law schools they attend, Harvard, Columbia, and Yale. Most of the people in government attended the colleges and those colleges and or law schools. And I think there may be some truth in that. And that brings us to a larger issue. And that is that this country lives under a tyranny of the Ivy League.
Oh, don't even get me started.
And it is a tyranny that is not earned. It's just the money continuing to talk.
Right.
A note coming in from Flavio in Wisconsin, who would know from whence he speaks. You know, Flavio was born and raised in Brazil. Well, up until they moved to the U.S., his family. As a South American, a Latin American Catholic, I think American Catholics are more Calvinistic Jansenist than Catholic. I think there's an argument to be made for that. They had to assimilate to the reigning Protestantism. When the Catholic theologian Christopher Dawson asked a Notre Dame audience, "Are you Catholics who happen to be American or Americans who happen to be Catholic?" the majority answered, "Americans who happen to be Catholic." And that of course also is where we get the idea of cafeteria Catholics.
Right.
Where they, you know, choose the doctrine they want to participate in, which is fine by me for the most part. Well, I mean, not that it matters, but that's the whole of Christianity anyway, is picking and choosing the Jesus that you like. But there's, you know, there's a there is within all that, of course, you know, you talk about the activist arm of the church. There's nothing more activist than the bizarre freaks of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops who run around every 4 years talking about who can and can't eat the magic cracker and drink the magic Kool-Aid because of how they feel, because of fetuses. And frankly, I think, you know, it should be made abundantly clear to them. And maybe 1,000 years from now, if this nation still exists, we'll finally get around to doing this. That somebody look at those bishops every time they do something like that and say, "Listen, assholes, you can be a politician or you can be a divine. You want to be a divine, you stay out of politics. You want to be in politics, you pay taxes. Which do you want, Bishop? And it takes us all the way back to the fundamental disconnect between Henry II and Thomas A. Becket. And, you know, Thomas A. Becket was a prick. So, you know, there's that.
But let me caveat that, because generally speaking, it's not the bishops who make those pronouncements. It's you have priests who do that, you know, like that nutball up in Grand Rapids about Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, but all the way back to 2004, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops was running around talking about that John Kerry couldn't have fucking communion because he didn't want to sew the vagina shut of every woman in America. That was the Conference of Catholic Bishops, and they're doing it again.
I'll have to go back and look and see if it's the conference or if it's individual bishops. Because I will tell you...
Check me, but I've seen too many stories. U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. No one should take communion if they support abortion. And somebody needs to tell them to shut the fuck up.
I mean, that... I have less of a... What I have a problem with is don't vote for somebody because they... are for abortion rights.
Well, they do, yeah, and that happens. That happens in pulpits, Protestant and Catholic alike, all over this country.
Right, but again, I have to research it, but I can tell you, and that's the other thing too, is that sometimes people who aren't Catholic don't get that when an individual priest speaks, that priest does not speak
for the church.
For the church, and a lot of times, because I can tell you, in my parish, you will find plenty of speaking against what's going on, but in terms of particular candidates, never. Never. And we are, during election time, they'll, hand out the stuff from the conference that says, look, here's, on these issues... Here's what the church might say, but that's the other thing too is that it is official church teaching that ultimately what a person does comes down to their conscience. The church sees itself as a guide; it sees itself as this is what we say is right and wrong, but it's up to the person's conscience is. What's the word I want? That's the final arbiter. But anyway, getting back to, the reason that you asked about why there's a disproportionate number of Catholics and Jews, to be honest, given the fact of the percentage on the court versus the percentage in the population, although you couldn't have half a justice. So, we can't really say that. But I tend to think, Bob, that if I were to come up with a reason, that's what the reason would be. I mean, who the hell knows what the reason is or what the reasons are? I tend to think that, you know, the reason that
One of the things that I think is telling, though, is that whereas the whatever stripe, whereas the religious contingent of the white wing of the court, wears their religion on their sleeves. You never got that sense from Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You don't get it from Elena Kagan. You don't get it from Sonia Sotomayor.
Yeah, no, I think you're dead on right there. I mean. If you didn't tell
and
me...
So, when you've got people like the Federalist Society out there, and of course Amy Coney Barrett is another one of these Federalist Society dirtbags, they are picked because they wear their radical religion on their sleeves.
Bingo.
They are picked because they have the temperament of an Iranian mullah.
Yeah, I agree.
Because theocracy is baked in. They want... They want theocracy in this country. They want religion to inform our day-to-day life. They want us, they want the sane among us not to be free from it, Steve.
I agree.
Oh, and by the way, this is entirely off topic. I touched on it on Friday on the front porch, and you were the one who chimed in. Give further thought if you don't mind. And I'll ask other members of the Horn Family Community Congregation about this too. But I'll take this moment to put a little bit of flesh on the bones. I'm thinking seriously about trying to run the Horn crowdfunding campaign in October, because I'd hoped that we would be past the economic crisis, and I'd hoped that we would be past the pandemic, but that, you know, hope in one hand and shit in the other and see which one fills up first.
Right.
But if we don't do it in October, that means we can't do it, that we can't even try until March. And in March, who knows? And that leaves me precious little time to do things like book hotel rooms, or facilities or anything like that, because shit starts filling up fast because of the tourism season here. So if we're hoping to have the Horn in 2021, I'm guessing, and I want the input of the community, we need to probably do it in October, and that's a hell of a lot of work to get that thing done, ready and rolling in 8 days, and I'll, you know, and it'll be 7, 6, 5 days, more or less, if I wait to get some sort of a consensus on Friday on the front porch, which I'm going to do, because the whole point here, so folks can understand, is to continue, and we've had some fantastic anonymous help in some aspects of this, but to try to make big repairs on this place so that it can survive, you know, this house can survive 10 or 15 or 20 or whatever more years, because I've talked a little bit about what the derecho did and how useless FEMA was. And there is, I mean, you know, there's stuff that absolutely has to be done. They just can't wait anymore. And so I'm hoping, and you know, there'll be premiums to it for people who want to kick in $10, $25, whatever. But the centerpiece of the whole thing is going to be the Horn Inn. And that's going to, and that will be a turnkey affair. Once you get here, nothing else to worry about. And we'll have tons of great barbecue and other good food. I'll be cooking my ass off during the whole time. We'll be, you know, we'll get some local music going.
Bluegrass? Some good bluegrass?
It depends on what I can find and who's playing. Every room is double occupancy.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be, you know, one or two people. It's just going to be a set price for one or two people.
Sure.
Like Tracy bringing Jan will be the same price as somebody coming alone, because the work is all the same.
It's all the same. I gotcha.
And, you know, hell, I'll probably go out and buy another smoker so that I can do the ribs and the chicken and the brisket all at the same time. It's going to be a hell of a thing. Just overall, you know, for instance, I've been talking about it for a long time. I'm going to pull together and publish a book of my poetry and essays.
Awesome.
And that'll be part of it. And, you know, there'll be an electronic version available. There'll be a hard copy version available. And using the model that Malloy used, you know, we'll do a reading and a round table and stuff like that, one evening. And just, you know, walking up and down that trail, I got to thinking, yeah, maybe some people will want to do that. Some people will want to see the local natural wonders.
You know, I was just going to say that you're going to have an awful lot of people, Bob, who've never been to West Virginia and who don't know. I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time there, but I've driven, you know, off the beaten path, and it's just some of the scenery and the landscape is breathtaking, and I think a lot of people don't know that.
And, you know, when you're doing a crowdfunding campaign, you have to take into account that, you know, the crowdfunder takes their VIG.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, the cost of producing this thing altogether. So I don't want anybody to go, you know, when they see what the number is for the Hornet, because, mm-hmm. you know, it'll probably be reduced by, you know, by $50 by the VIG, and then probably by something like $400 by the cost of the weekend itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping I'm going to set it up in such a way that we've got a meetable goal, because, you know, with Kickstarter, if you don't hit the goal, you don't get the money.
Yep. No, I know.
But we will create plenty of room for hopefully as many people in this community as want to come. And I'd love to see, you know, I'd love to see 50 to, you know, 50 people come. I can do barbecue.
Oh, that'd be great.
I can do barbecue for 50 in a minute. And, you know, I'll invite some special guests. You know, I'll invite Mike and Molly up. I'll invite, you know, Dr. Bill, Boss Man Wayne, people you've heard about for years. And just try to put together an agenda that, and then one of the things that I thought would be really, really fun would be to do a real live, no kidding, in-person front porch. On a front porch.
Oh, that would be... And then also broadcast it.
Yeah, broadcast it.
That would be awesome. That would be straight up awesome.
And so, you know, by all means, feel free to shoot me an email, bobkincaid@gmail.com. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. And let me know, you know, if that's something you'd be up for. Ralph's just jumped in and said, go for it, Bob. Go for it in October. Because the other thing that October lets us do is if it fails, we can try again in March.
Sure.
But I'd rather not, you know, because if I can nail this down in October, I can probably get better prices and have better choices. So I wanted to run that past you for your pondering and consideration, as well as that of the overall community. And by the way, a little fan mail, if we can call it that. Our buddy Tom jumped in and said, great conversation. Thank you, Bob and Steve, for the discussion of Catholicism and politics. It's giving me a better insight into my son's viewpoint. He converted to Catholicism a couple of years ago, and I'm constantly running into pitfalls. Oh, I can only imagine. That's Tom in sunny San Rafael.
Right? You know that I did, right?
You did what?
Converted.
Oh, I know.
I didn't grow up Catholic.
Oh, what were you raised as?
Nothing. In fact, I was confirmed, which is the last sacrament of initiation, when I was 17 in high school, and my father was very much against it. And eventually my dad converted, and I was my dad's, they now call him sponsor. It used to be godfather. I was my dad's sponsor for coming into the church, as well as the primary witness at the wedding, at his wedding when he was married in the church.
Wow. Another note coming in from Jack in Shreveport, subject line Catholics. Mm-hmm. Late last night, I was browsing the TV guide, happened to see info on a show on one of our many, many, many religious channels. Remember, Jackson, Louisiana, Stan. It was a Catholic network, and the show was something like Theocracy Today, maybe. But the title of the episode was Socialism, Today's Social Justice Movement, or some crap from like 3 years ago. There was a host and two guests, and there were academics, not flashy fast talkers, and the discussion started very reasonably. The host pulled a document out, and when he says the host, he's not talking about the cracker, he's talking about the person in front of the TV, in front of the TV camera. The host pulled a document out and said it had the church's stance on how people should be treated or something. They read off 10 to 20 simple, reasonable ways one should behave, and I think I had no major negative reaction to any of them. I think I was able to watch 20 or 30 minutes into the hour program before I had to turn it off. Didn't take very long until they were throwing around the usual Republican buzzwords and totally misrepresenting what I think most people on the left want. The reasoned thought of the academics had turned into brain-dead zombies who couldn't get past the old godless commie extremists. Yes, the left was going to use government to enforce that all people must be the same and all people would be lazy and they would trash property because there's no way multiple people would ever care about maintaining any property if they didn't own it themselves. Anyway, it seemed either the church was directing how Catholics should strive to set government principles and how money and property and social programs should work, or these guys were spewing what the Republican Party and their rich friends demand. And
I mean, if you want to see how radical a lot of the church people were, look up Dorothy Day, the Catholic social, the Catholic,
oh, yeah,
the Catholic
right.
worker.
And remember with the ascension of John Paul II, one of the first things he did was to absolutely go to war with Central and South American divines liberation theology. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had that little former member of the Hitler Youth, you know, Benny the Rat, as his enforcer. That's so easily forgotten. Mark points out, Frank Schaefer, writer and former powerful evangelist, points out William Barr is Catholic with dangerous religious intentions, and that's the ones I'm talking about. These, you know, the weird ones. The people who follow that Opus Dei Spanish fascist priest that was all snuggly and cuddly with Franco, and a miserable right wing fascist during the Spanish Civil War.
There's another one.
Jimmy in the Great Northwest says tithes. I ask, how can they fund free schooling? Tithes.
But they don't. But you don't have to. There's no in Catholicism. You don't tithe.
But they get the money out of you somehow or another.
Yeah, but I mean.
I mean, in the Greek Orthodox Church, you pay for your fucking seat. You pay an annual fee.
It doesn't happen.
What did I say? Says Flavio. American Catholics are more John Birch Society than Dorothy Day. Exactly.
Yeah.
In regard to the Jewish community, Lee says, subject line converting, if you want to become Jewish, doggone it, I had it up there. If you want to become Jewish, you have to be asked to confirm that intent three times. Studying is also necessary. Mm-hmm. And there's a pop quiz.
No, Catholicism, same way. Well, you know, that's the other thing too, is that when you start to say something like the church says, that can be, I mean, you have the order that of the order of priests who owns and who runs the parish where I am is really freaking liberal. I mean, we have gay pastors and they make no bones about it from the pulpit that they are gay. And, you know, there's a feast day. I don't remember when it is, called the Feast of the Holy Family, which I think is actually January, in the beginning of the year. My pastor gave a homily about gay families. And he got shit from some of the parishioners. And he basically said, you don't like it, go somewhere else.
Bugger off.
Yeah. I mean, it really runs. And of course, you know, a lot of it has to do with the fact that I live in New York City where, you know, but you're going to find, but again, you know, going back to very, to, you know, well, let me just say this about Dorothy Day. She was an awful lot of people called her a communist.
Oh yeah.
If you look at the Catholic Worker, that was some very, very pro-union, poor person stuff.
Because those are the people that Jesus hung out with. But you'd never know it to talk to the Catholic members of the Supreme Court, possibly with the exception of Sonia Sotomayor. We're apparently in Flavio's wheelhouse. He says, "I've read more encyclicals than my parish priests here. True fact." Doesn't surprise me in Nicholsworth. And by the way, I'm glad I brought up the issue of the horn in, Steve, because it's getting some responses. Jimmy just said, the horn in, I'm in. I'd love to meet the horn family in person. Coming from Seattle, I want to be seeing your part of the country. I'm down. And if you need help burning, I'm there. Meaning, you know, barbecuing. Cool. And Jeremy said, go for it, Bob. If we can do it, maybe I'll ramble down our shared mountains as well and join on that front porch.
But I'm going to say one last thing, then I'm going to go. Have you noticed yet that your taste buds are a lot more effective since you've been on your journey here?
I think either I'm replacing my cigarette, the physical hand to mouth oral fixation with food, or else I'm liking food more. And that's why I'm going on these walks and making myself huff and puff. Yes. But where I really noticed it today and the other walks, because I'm trying to do it every day.
Good for you.
And I'm not just sort of ambling along either. I'm like I said, I walk faster than some people run.
You're run walking.
No, it's just I'm long-legged and I want to get where I'm going.
Ah, okay. Gotcha.
Pisses Agnes off in the store. I had college buddies who were shorter than me, and one of my tall buddies and I would be ambling along High Street in Morgantown, and we'd turn around and look back, and there would stand our buddy who was height challenged, and he'd just be looking daggers at the both of us because he just, you know, he those little legs of his just couldn't keep up.
Right.
And so what I have noticed, and what I noticed particularly today when I was really pushing myself, and I know it doesn't sound like much to say that, you know, I ran 125 yards or whatever, but I did it at the beginning and it was easy. And I got to get into stretching and warming up and getting a, you know, getting that in better shape. But again, it's walk before you, it's crawl before you walk. But when I ran that trestle at the beginning, it was like, didn't even get winded. When I had just climbed up a mile of narrow gauge track and I got to the trestle and said, by God, I'm running this thing. I was halfway across. Everything from my ankle to my ass was on fire. And I was at that, you know, push it, get through it. And when I got to the other side of the trestle, well, I couldn't have done it if I was still smoking. I couldn't have done it.
You felt like jumping up like Sylvester Stallone and on the steps in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Oh, let me clear something up here. Seeing a pattern here, Darlene says, I can't tell you how many people I know that were brought up by atheists or brought up faithless and became religious. And those who were brought up religious like me and couldn't get away from that stuff fast enough and became atheists or agnostics or a combo of the two. There's something to that. I'm sure you and Steve will proffer your theories. And then Darlene says, which October for a Hornin, this or 2021? No. What I'm saying is I want to do the crowdfunding campaign this October for the Hornin next year. And the plan, at least as it stands, and it can be modified depending on the progress of the pandemic and whatnot, the plan is to do it on the first Saturday in June
of 2021. But I think it's a good thing, regardless, to do the crowdfunding, because then we get if things do go forward next year, then we're not scrambling to pull together the funds. That we get the funds and they're sitting there, and all we have to do is plan. I think that's dead on right.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, I order up all the meat, and I will, because I'm trying to eat less meat now, eat more vegetables. I'll work up a vegetarian, a vegan alternative. Even when I did the Malloy Mountain getaway back a year ago last June, I had a vegan choice that was actually well received by the vegans in the group, and it was all gone by the time it was over. So. We'll do all that, and you know, there are fun places to go for people who want to have. I mean, they're hopefully by then we'll be able to go and have a beer or something like that at you know, my friend, he's been on the program, Lewis, who runs Secret Sandwich, owns Secret Sandwich Society, and runs a little place called the Grove, has a fabulous selection of beers. There's a wonderful little bar called Maggie's that makes great cocktails and has an in-house cat, the mayor of Fayetteville, named Walter. he's an orange tabby who wants nothing more than to sit on everybody's lap. Everybody gets cat lap sat if you sit down at Maggie's, Walter will come up, sit on your lap, check you out, and then go on to somebody else.
But you don't touch him.
No, he'll accept petting.
But on his terms.
Yeah, absolutely on his terms. And when he's done, he's done.
He's done.
Yeah.
In typical cat. What's the word I want? Typical cat.
But they do a great job. There's a cocktail. Every day has a different cocktail that's a special, and it's something unusual, and they're just really creative. And like I said, there's all kind of trails. If we set up enough free time, people could maybe even take a rock climbing class.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I'm going to step off because there's 10 minutes to go, and if anybody wants to call in for a bit, I don't.
Yeah, Scott's been trying to reach, so.
Okay.
We'll see if he wants to jump back in. Steve, thanks for a great conversation. We've started the week off with a couple of fantastic conversations between last night with Darlene and Billable, and tonight with you. This really is what the program's all about.
That's one of the reasons I love it.
Well, thank you kindly, Steve. You take care.
Take care. Have a good night, Bob. Take care. Okay.
All right. Bye now.
Bye now.
And that's our buddy Steve in New York. Man, we covered some ground. I mean, covered some ground. Jack in Shreveport says, whew, horn in. I'm glad I don't have to try to make West Virginia in a couple of weeks or so. I've been computering so much, I can't think. I understand. No. This would not be the time. We are not going to horn in the middle of my county being red. I'm not that dumb. Mike in Cascadia says, hey, Bob, I'm interested. I'd love to meet the fellow, our fellow Hornedanistas. And also, I'd like to hike and see some of the public lands in your neighborhood. Are those federal public lands? Yes, that is the New River Gorge National River. If so, they're probably on the menu with this new SCOTUS staring at us right down the barrel. Recently, MIT applauded a federal public lands transfer in Utah. This time, Federal Bureau of Reclamation projects were just given to Utah. So enjoy our federal public lands now while we still have them, and continue to fight and raise hell to keep them mine and yours and ours. Signed, Mike, mowing and listening in Cascadia. I love mowing grass all over the country with folks. It sounds like a lovely evening in Cascadia there. The light is already gone from the sky here. Dear God. Orange Tabby, says Lee in New York. I knew someone with an orange tabby named Ketchup. I can't even imagine. At least his name's Walter and not Donald, you know? But Bob, says Jeremy in Vermont, we could do it while your county's red. It's freedom, and after all, it's in the Constitution! Precisely. And there's Scott. Hey, Scott.
Hey, baby, what's going on?
I don't know it, man. How about you?
It's all good here at Shea Guru, I'm telling you. I've been out of the...
There's a lot going on down here.
That's right. Balloons and hot dogs for all the kids, and pony rides. Don't forget the pony rides.
And cutout records that we never played on air with the little hole punched in the corner.
That's right. Cutouts, baby, as far as you can see. Anyway, I know the time is fleeting. I wanted to, quash any rumors. Reports of my having fallen off the planet are totally unfounded. The days are hot, and I sleep during the days to take advantage of the cool evenings here at my place. But the weather is changing. It's getting dark earlier. So today is the first day of fall, so all will be well. There will be more of me as the days go on. As the days draw down to a precious few, isn't that the September song? Yeah,
something like that. Hey, you being in San Diego and all, and I was thinking about some other members of the Horn family community down there. We've got several San Diegans.
Yes, we do.
And this is an unpaid product placement or unpaid service placement, but I've been meaning to do it for the longest time. I think I may have mentioned it once. I need to mention it more. I've got a dear friend who practices law in San Diego now.
Oh.
And if you are, if you've been hurt by some corporation, or if you've been hurt in a wreck, or frankly, he does, you know, he does all kinds of general practice of law stuff in the San Diego area. I cannot recommend to you highly enough this friend of mine. His law office is there in some part of San Diego. His name is Tom Rist, R-I-S-T. And
yeah, I'll write that down.
What a friend he has been to the organizations and groups that deal with mountaintop removal. He has been, I mean, there's nothing he hasn't done to try to advance the struggle against that pernicious practice, but he moved out San Diego way, and he's practicing out there now, and like I said, I cannot recommend enough that if you are in need of a lawyer, make your first phone call to Tom Rist, and if he can't do it, he'll know somebody who can.
Okay, well, I'll put him on the old Rolodex.
Yeah, R-I-S-T, Tom Rist.
Okay. I just had a couple of quick things. And by the way, a stellar show. I picked the right day to drop in. You know, between Steve in Georgetown and Steve in New York, I almost didn't call because I knew I wouldn't, you know, match up to their...
It's a program of S's. Guys. Steve, and Scott. Bunch of S's.
There you go. But anyway, and you mentioned the poem, Ozymandias. Is that the pronunciation?
Yeah, Ozymandias.
The third from last episode in one of my favorite series, Breaking Bad, has that as its title. So maybe that'll be an enticement to get you to watch the rest of that
series, Bob. And it's Shelley. It's Shelley.
Yeah, I knew it was one of them.
I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
Yeah, and that title and that poem fit that episode perfectly. And anybody who knows the series Breaking Bad will remember it well. God, what a fucking stellar piece of television that show was. But anyway, that's not why I called. You mentioned it. I thought I'd mention it. I've got a quick TV viewing tip and then a couple of quick comments about our vacancy on the Supreme Court. Tonight on PBS, Frontline, they do this every 4 years, The Choice, 2020 edition, Trump versus Biden. It's going to be 2 hours of good TV watching. So PBS tonight, check your local listings, 8 p.m., I think, or 9 p.m. But it's they do this. The past few cycles, they've done The Choice right a few weeks before the election. And it's just great television. I mean, I love PBS anyway. Now, as for poor Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I knew that you know, that she was not going to last forever. But if she could only have held out, God bless her, for just a few more months. But here we are. It is what it is.
And as I noted, last night, if she couldn't make it to January 21st, 2021, this is exactly the right time.
Yes, because, see, I think there's a better than even chance, if I'm reading the numbers right, there's a better than even chance that we're going to retake the White House and we're going to retake the Senate. And these shenanigans that Mitch and Lindsey and Trump and the rest of them, that horrid crew is trying to pull, It's think of strawberry soft swirl. This is the little curly Q on top of the cone. This is, yeah, except it ain't strawberry soft swirl, and I won't ruin anybody's dinner. Use your imagination. This is the little swirly thing at the top of the cone that Trump and Mitch and all the rest of them on the Republican side have served up to the American public. This is their, you know, it's the nicely, what was that dog food you were talking about?
The farmer's dog, yes.
Yeah, this is the finely wrought solid residue from your neighborhood dog on a cone, served up from the hand of Mitch McConnell himself, wearing his funny paper hat and his goofy smile on his ugly face. So, but who didn't see this coming? You knew that he wanted that third justice, and you knew that all, like Ron Ziegler, President Nixon's press secretary, was quoted once as saying, all previous statements are inoperative. This, what I'm about to say, is the operative statement. And this is how these fuckers play. And I know this is no news flash to you or the Horn family, but this is what they're up to.
It's so who they are.
I can only hope. Yeah, it's in their DNA. I can only hope that we have a situation like we had in 52. I mean, 1952 was the first time a Republican gained the presidency since Herbert Hoover, or Hubert Hoover. And that was in, what, 1928? Was what, you know, so we went a good 20 years without having another Republican president. And a lot of that was as a result of their ineptitude and their haughtiness. And maybe we can do that again. Maybe we, and it'll take 20 years to clean up the mess of the past 4 years.
Well, you're in line with what I've been saying all along. This is the work of generations.
Yeah, yeah. And there's all of this, and I don't want to relitigate 2016. By God, it seems like forever ago. But all of this could have been avoided. And it was on the basis of 77,400 votes in three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. God damn it, if we can't take those states this time and a bunch more besides, then we probably deserve four more years, and I hate to say that. But I know that we're up for and up to the task at hand. And God bless you for getting your ballot in early. And by the way, my hat is, you could knock me over with a feather when I saw the other day on Facebook that you had gone like 9 days. Today is the ninth day of no smokes.
Yes.
I am so happy and proud for you.
Well, thank you, Scott.
And God knows, you know how radio people are. I was a dedicated two-pack-a-day man for years, and I quit in August of 1999, I think it was. It'll be 21. It's been 21 years. So if I can do it, I know you can do it, and you will sleep better. Your sense of smell will be better. Your sense of taste will be better, and you'll be even.
You mean
more
I'm going to smell better?
No. You're going to stink just like you always did, Bob.
Oh, okay. Bob. Damn it.
You'll know when it's time to jump in the old wash tub and let Agnes take a scrub brush to you and your parts. So, anyway, I couldn't have been more happy to hear that news. And good for you. Good on you. Good on you. What are cigarettes costing nowadays?
They're north of $6 a pack.
Oh, well, they must be 12 bucks a pack out here. Because everything's higher in California, including the Californians. But I'm telling you, I'm so happy for you. And the benefits of being smoke-free are tremendous.
Well, I mean, I come from that old cigarette-smoking radio tradition.
I know you do.
I mean, it's nothing I'm proud of, but, you know, I had an ashtray in here. Notice had. Agnes took it out.
Yeah.
What would happen is I begin the program with a lit cigarette.
Yeah, I know. God, you're reading
my
book.
And go through the better part of a pack in the course of 3 hours. Bear in mind, actually smoking, probably four. Not even half of them. Okay, yeah. Maybe the equivalent of five.
Yeah, you light them, take a hit, put it down.
Well, more than anything else, you hold it in your finger and you talk with it.
Yeah.
And
been
so
there, done that.
I tried the patch, but the dreams
couldn't keep it lit, could you?
No, I couldn't keep it lit worth a fuck. And it smelled like burning plastic.
Yeah.
But the dreams, two or three nights of the patch. Cause what I'd do is I'd get to bedtime and then I'd slap the patch on. So I wouldn't Jones in my sleep. I mean, that was a real possibility and I wouldn't wake up in danger of reaching over and lighting one up.
Yeah.
But
oh, I forgot about the dreams.
The dreams on the patch are like watching David Lynch's home movies. Or perhaps Fellini's.
Yeah.
And that just had to go. So now I'm using the pouches because there's been a proliferation. What the fuck, really? Robert in Australia. Australian $48.50 for a pack of Marlboro Golds in Australia. That's U.S. $36. That, holy Robert says, fuck. Is how you stop people from smoking, or else you get them to roll their own.
Jesus.
But now I don't have to worry about the flight to Australia. I'm not going to be taking it anytime soon, but no, that used to be a problem. Thinking about, you know, oh, really? 8 hours on an airplane? Oh, fuck that.
So what are the...
Or 26.
Are these pouches?
Well, there has been a proliferation in recent years of... It is nicotine. It is pure flavored nicotine. It is not tobacco.
You're not talking about snus.
No, I'm not talking about snus, whatever. No, because that's still tobacco. This is nothing but nicotine that's been extracted from tobacco and flavored with, cinnamon, spearmint, wintergreen, peppermint, cool mint, mango, honey lemon, black cherry.
Jesus.
I'm still waiting for chocolate and creme brulee because, those would be yummy. I'd probably just chew those. And you tuck them up, not between your, not on your lower, but between your upper lip and your gum, because there's less salivary glands up there.
Yeah.
And it provides you so you don't just, and what I'm doing now is I'm spacing out my pouches and putting more and more time between them. Because for me, the Jones is a pain in the ass, but it's the physical association and the hand-to-mouth oral fixation and all of that that was the real madness. And those first couple of days of getting in the car and just immediately reaching down into the cubbyhole for a pack of cigarettes and the lighter, that made me feel a little crazy.
Well, somewhere around here, and I'll send you a copy of it when I find the book, somewhere around here I've got a book that was written by Harry Reasoner, and he, in the book, he did a little essay called On Smoking. You might even be able to find it online, but he talked about it as a form of punctuation in our life. And I think you'll get that concept because, like you say, you get in the car, you reach down to the cubbyhole, you pick up the phone, you crook the thing on one shoulder and grab for your pack of whatever they are.
And I've passed another milestone. This is 3 days now, or is it four? No, it's 4 days now that I'm able to have a cup of decaf in the morning and not just go howling mad for a cigarette.
Yeah. It'll take about 21 days for you to really start merging into that lane of being a non-smoker. And once you've gotten to that 21-day mark, You've pretty well worked.
I'm trying to give myself the best chance I've got. So yeah, I'm going and walking a couple of miles every day, weather permitting. I got to figure. See, that's one of the things. One of the reasons I was complaining about the coming of cold weather is that as it gets colder, that walk is going to get harder.
Yeah.
And I got to find something I can do indoors that will provide the same level of, you know, blood pumping kind of, right.
Get you one of them gizmos.
Or maybe by then I'm just, maybe by then, if the plan goes correctly, maybe by then I'm just, I've advanced to the point where I can, you know, I'll just be one of those hardcores and go out and go for a run, no matter how damn cold it is.
Yeah. Well, any form of exercise and thinking healthy, thinking that you're way better off. But like I say, the magic number is 21 days. Once you have hit 21 days smoke-free, you're well on your way, as long as you choose on a daily basis or a momently basis that this
And I'm, you know, this is all part of an overall program. Not only did I quit smoking, but, you know, a couple of months back, I completely quit drinking.
Oh, Lord.
You know, not even
so. Sniffing glue?
That's out, too. and I'm not, you know, I'm not doing, you know, I gave up the peyote. But the only, about the only vice I've got left is food. And, yeah. And I'm trying to, and like I said, I found those wonderful little, Volpe, prosciutto wrapped around a piece of mozzarella. I have one of those every day and it's just wonderful. And I'm eating a lot of yogurt and soup and, you know, maybe one really kind of sturdy meal late in the evening. And I haven't eaten garbage fast food, in a while either. So with any luck
That's
at all,
good.
It, because like I said, I had some blood work done. I didn't like my A1C. My triglycerides were high, according to the medical professionals, but I looked at him and said, no, those are really low. They said, what? And I said, oh yeah, no, my triglycerides are high at 1300. Because, you know, but I've never had better cholesterol in my life. It was at 148. But I've got, you know, and so with the exercise, I'll bring down the A1C and I'll bring down the triglycerides. And then on top of it all, I walked into the Wiggling Pig today, and, you know, I've talked about how, you know, the guy there, great guy, will try to find just about anything I asked him. It only took him 2 years to find Kaneka sausage and get it in, and I'm not giving up my Kaneka. No, fuck no. But I asked him to go and find me that Mayfield Creamery orange pineapple ice cream, and he did it. And you know what happened? He got it in, and then his grocery store freezer died. And so six containers of that wonderful orange pineapple ice cream just went bad.
Yeah.
And it was, I could reach it. I could almost touch it. But you couldn't open the door because he had a strap around it to make sure nobody did, because he can't sell it.
Yeah.
Ugh. And by the way, $6 for a pack of cigarettes, Darlene in Connecticut says, that's nothing. Try $13.87 in Connecticut between price, $9.52 in tax, $4.35. Deep bow from the taxi to death state. Well, better to be taxed to death than smoked to death. And Darlene adds, exactly, Scott. I was pessimistic last night on my call into the horn for a reason. The pigs are ramming this bitch through no matter what. They can't replace our beloved RBG fast enough. And you know how bad it is? Here's how bad it is. Chuck Schumer tried to introduce a non-binding, just a resolution in honor of the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And the non-binding resolution included the words, my most fervent wish is that I will not be replaced until a new president is installed. And lo and behold, that filthy little son of a bitch, that dirty little piece of shit on a prick, Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed booger-eating future king of America, stopped it.
Yeah, well.
Because he said that we couldn't include that language. And let's see, Cruz says he wants to modify the resolution and delete Schumer's language about when RBG wants the seat filled. Cruz wants to insert RBG, quote, knocking the idea of packing the court.
No, that's...
And so this dysfunctional, miserable, goddamn Republican Senate can't even pass a simple resolution honoring the life of an American patriot.
Well, that's all the more reason to replace their shabby asses come November 3rd.
Well, unfortunately, Raffaellito's not on the ballot.
I know, but...
But John Cornholio is, and we can take it out on him.
That's right, and we may well. See, that's the thing. This is when you catch these fuckers napping, maybe on some level... They see the handwriting on the wall. And as the noted philosopher Red Fox once said, when you see the handwriting on the wall, you're in the toilet.
Yes.
Maybe they know. Maybe this is their last-ditch effort, you know, to fuck things up. Well, you know, if there's no way around it, like Steve from New York said, we'll just have to dance with it and do better next time and so on down the line. But goddamn it. If we don't know by now, American voters, if you don't know by now that these people are not here in your best interest, and the best thing that we can do as a nation is to keep them away from the levers of power for the next 20 years or so until we straighten this shit out. That is my mandate, my person.
It'll take that long.
And then it will. It will, because... You go back to the time of Reagan, and even before, the signs were showing that they were up to something, and they were mad that they were out of power in certain ways, and they were determined that fucking moral, so-called moral majority kickstarted this thing back in the late 70s. I remember it well,
because among other things, I remember being in a high school speech competition and winning my region's extemporaneous speaking segment for, I drew, just the luck of the draw, I drew the question of address of dealing with Jerry Falwell, and I gave him a rousing round of the moral majority is neither moral nor a majority. And I won, and I probably would have wound up state champion, but I got in a car wreck and couldn't go.
Well, they have been rat fucking us every which way they can ever since, and it's time to say enough. And that's just where I'm at with it. I am so tired.
I know, and we're running out of time, so I got to work some things in. Randy in PA just wrote and said the price on a pack of cigarettes in Canada is sky high because they have national health care, and that's if I have any regrets at all about not smoking, it is that I have fucked. Little children in America who need health care. Because the expanded CHIP program was expanded on the back of cigarette smokers.
Yeah.
And, you know, non-smokers, you're not helping to take care of little children who need health insurance. It was on the back of smokers.
Yeah.
So I've screwed over a whole bunch of children by quitting smoking. Now, maybe someday we can find a way to provide health care to children who need it so that we can all contribute to the effort. You know, democracy and all that stuff. Maybe we could tax, what? Sugar. Maybe we could tax sugar. Maybe we could tax sweeteners in general and bring in the aspartame and sucralose crowd too, and fund health care that way. I'd say soda pop, but there are too many people that don't drink soda pop. But sugar and artificial sweeteners, that's an idea. And then we could all take part in taking care of the health care needs of America's children. And then there's always going to be some people that don't even do that. But then, you know, for the Republicans, maybe we could put an excise tax on fucking hypocrisy.
You'd have to hire more people to count and account. and run the numbers.
Yeah, we could reduce the Republicans in the Congress to fucking paupers on that.
The only thing that is, that there is a more inexhaustible supply of than fracked oil and gas is GOP hypocrisy.
Well, you know, there's a famous court case out there that says the power to tax, and it's an early case, the power to tax is the power to destroy. And if we were to tax Republican hypocrisy, we could destroy them once and for all.
Sure.
But anyway, Scott, I got to get out of here because, well, we're 20 minutes overtime, but I enjoyed the conversation, and we'll get we'll get more conversation going at a later date, shall we say.
Okay. Well, please know, Bob, that I and the rest of the Horn family, especially in the former smokers, are sending you supportive energy as you go down this path. And I just, if I had my hat nearby, I would tip my hat in your general direction. It's, I know it's one of the hardest things I ever did, but by God, if I can do it, I know you can do it, because in more ways than I can count in the remaining time, is you're a better man than I. Okay? So there you go. That's my 2 cents worth.
All right, and, thanks, Scott. You have I do appreciate it, and the encouragement means a ton. And we will talk soon, all right?
Okay, take care.
All right, bye now.
See ya.
And so we come to the end of the program with some bonus time, 20 minutes of bonus time here. Thank you to all of you who keep the program on the air. Thanks to all of our subscribers. Thanks to everybody who jumped in on the Raise a Toast to RBG Challenge, courtesy of Larry in Liberalville. We got fundraising free radio all the way to the end of September, with the single exception, and I'll put this out there maybe for folks who maybe take the podcast and or maybe you're new to the program. If you jump in on Tony and Chico's new subscriber challenge, where he's willing to double your first month's subscription, well, remember, you're setting yourself back not quite a whole stick of gum per day for this program. And there are 9 more $10 slots courtesy of Tony. And hopefully those will get filled before the month is out, because we can always need new, we always need new subscribers. It'd be nice to get up to that happy 100 or something like that at some point in time. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program, no matter what method you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Steve and Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Remember, brand new Malloy on the way, and I've had notes from folks telling me that that listening at headon.live really is the best way to listen to Malloy. And jump in the chat room if you want. Gather around the Truth Seeker campfire. But new Malloy on the way at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And, well, we're just pleased and honored that we get to run the Malloy program here. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Please be careful. The pandemic is nowhere near over. Hell, we're still waiting for round two to start because we can't get past stage one. So stay home if you can. If you can't do that and you have to be out and about, well, wash your hands, wear your mask, wear your gloves, don't touch your face. Keep a social distance of 10 feet or more, if at all humanly possible, based on the advice of our dear friend Paul from Parts Unknown. And if you see somebody coming towards you saying, "We don't know what Ruth Bader Ginsburg wanted," avoid that person like the plague, because they are. Later, y'all.